Salutations on this this fine Tuesday. I want to welcome everybody to our third Military Munition Support Services webinar for fiscal year 2014. Gene's gone over the instructions and administrative announcements, and you know, as usual, EPA's Kluin staff has just been terrific to work with in order to bring you these webinars. So our sincere thanks to Gene and company for their support. We're also extremely grateful to all of you for your interest and time in joining us to help further share knowledge and the continual improvement of our M2S2 industry. You know, the theme for this month's webinar is munitions classification, and I suspect it will probably be one of the most popular topics for the entire year. And I thought this quote was particularly apt for today's session because for years, our typical approach toward responding to buried munitions, that's been analogous, you know, to searching for a black cat in a dark room, and, you know, there may not even be a cat in the room. We dig and we dig and we dig, and every now and then we find the unexploded ordnance that we think might be down there. But that's all changing. You know, we're now starting to build some tools and some processes which can illuminate the room to see, you know, if indeed there is a black cat hiding in there. And that's really what today's session is all about. I also thought the Where's Waldo game is another good analogy for our munitions response work. You know, we want to find Waldo, but it's really, really hard to differentiate Waldo from all the other clutter that kind of looks like Waldo. And, you know, that's what our geophysicist's job is really kind of all about. You know, finding the lethal Waldos. You know, maybe this ought to be the certification tattoo once we hammer out the qualification requirements for the advanced classification operators. Our list of speakers today, you know, it reads like a who's who in advanced classification. And I got to tell you, these folks flat out know their stuff, and we're very fortunate to have them, you know, share it with us. Amy Walker with the Huntsville Center, she volunteered to be the architect for today's webinar, and she's been terrific at getting all the puzzle pieces to line up. So gold medal for Ms. Walker in the Advanced Classification Freestyle event. And we structured today's webinar with the project managers and technical managers in mind. You know, it's going to be centered around utilization of advanced classification in production types of munitions response projects, rather than research-oriented projects. So the talks are going to have quite a bit of practical application considerations with a smattering of technical material.
An anonymous participant has joined the conference.
If we've missed the mark with this strategy, then, you know, please let us know on the seminar evaluations after the session today. And I'm Dwayne Ford. I'll be facilitating the session, trying to hold our line and keeping this from being a Jamaican bobsled run. Here's the agenda of the things that we're going to be covering in today's seminar. And Gene has gone over the details about the webinar, but I do want to emphasize that word-of-mouth advertising is the best way for us to continue to provide these webinars and share information across our M2S2 spectrum. After today's session, we are halfway through the season, so it'll be time for the All-Star break. We've got three more webinars scheduled for this fiscal year. I'm confident they're all going to be excellent, so please register for them if you haven't already done so. And at the last webinar, we debuted our survey question tools, and we really like the utility of them for collecting good input from our diverse M2S2 audience. So we're using them again today, and if you didn't get a chance to provide your input to the survey questions before the webinar started while everybody was still joining, we're going to put those back up during intermission, and you can vote then. So please vote responsibly for the candidate of your choice. The M2S2 webinars, they are recorded and archived, so if you missed one or want to go back and review an earlier presentation, they're all there for you, and you can view them at your leisure and comfort. You know, it isn't too early for us to start preparing for the M2S2 webinars in FY15, and to do that, I need more speakers and topics, so do your civic duty and nominate someone else before they nominate you. I don't always work munitions projects, but when I do, I practice the three R's of explosive safety. So stay safe, my friends. And this year, we're doing something a little different with our keynote presentations. Since the Corps of Engineers, the Military Munitions Design Centers are really our centers of gravity for technical execution of munitions projects, we wanted to give each of them a brief opportunity to talk to the MTSU community about their respective design centers. We heard from the Huntsville and the Baltimore Design Centers during our first two FY14 webinars. So today we have the Chief of the Range Support Center, Monique Osterman, and she has a panel.
Hi everyone, I'm Monique Osterman and I am pulling up my presentation right now. Today I want to talk about how the Range Support Center is organized, some of our capabilities, our customers, and then we're going to highlight a few of our projects. And to join me is going to be James Speck, Steve Smith, John Jackson, and James Ostry to talk about a few of their projects. The Range Support Center is a matrix organization with technical staff from five districts, Tulsa, Fort Worth, Albuquerque, Los Angeles, and Sacramento. Our technical staff includes geochemists, geophysicists, geologists, risk assessors, engineers, regulatory specialists, ordnance and explosive safety specialists, and much, much more. We are one of the five design centers that answers to USAID's headquarters. On the screen, you can see our geographic areas, how they're broken up, and who are the leads within those states. We work on a variety of programs to include the formerly used defense site, but the base realignment and closure with BRAC, installation restoration program. We have supported the EPA, and we support active installations with the range maintenance. We have capacity on contracts to include SWERS on the mega contract. We do standalone contracts. We work with large business, small business, 8As, and all of the above. We do performance-based contracts for fixed price contracts. All five of the district offices are experienced in military munitions award. So that's a little bit about how the support center is set up. I kind of want to turn it over here now to James Speck with Fort Ord so he can tell you a little bit about his project.
Thanks, Monique. Hey, folks, my name is James Speck. I'm the program manager for Fort Ord at the Sacramento Corps of Engineers. I'm going to be talking about the Range Support Center munitions response remedial action that we're accomplishing at Fort Ord currently. This program is being executed over approximately 6,700 acres area. We divided that range area up into units of about 200 to 400 acres each. What makes this particular project unique is that we utilize prescribed burning to clear the vegetation prior to surface clearance due to the endangered and threatened vegetation, the flora, on Fort Ord. So our burn unit, which is what we call the units when we do the burns, the burn unit remedial action sequence is essentially to do perimeter mastication of the burning to clear the vegetation, 100% surface clearance followed by DGM, and then we do subsurface clearance as necessary. We generally schedule two burns per year, and the entire start-to-finish effort for a burn unit is about 1.5 years. Given that and the number of burn units remaining, we expect this project to continue for about another decade or so. And Monique, if you could flip the slides, you folks will see here on the left-hand side, we've got a picture of a helicopter doing the ignition where we drop jelly fuel from the helicopter to begin the burn. Center picture on the top is the helicopter monitoring of the burn. And the bottom picture and the right-hand picture are helicopter and ground suppression of the burn when the burn is complete. And the burn takes roughly about 3 hours, 3 to 4 hours from start to finish. If you could do the next slide, Monique, what you'll see if we have done everything correctly. Looking at this picture, you see that we've got a stratified plume between 2,000 and 3,000 feet. Moving to the southwest here over the communities without falling on the communities, and moving out into the Pacific Ocean where it disperses. That's the highlights on Port Ord, and at this point I will transfer it over to Steve Smith.
Thanks, James. This is Steve Smith. I'm the program manager for Fort Wingate here in Fort Worth, Texas. And I want to talk with you about a project we're doing. It's excavating and sifting a 32-acre hazardous waste management unit, which is a fancy term for a former open burning, open detonation grounds. And you can see a picture on that on the right. In there, we've got a remote-controlled excavator with several armored trucks, as well as a remote-controlled loader. We have a 3-acre sift plant with all these features you see here on the PowerPoint, and I'll get to that here in a minute. And another key feature we have out at Fort Wingate is that we do our MEC destruction and a Resource Conservation Recovery Act permitted detonation pit and burn pan, which is called a Corrective Action Management Unit, or CAMU. And you can see a shot there of white phosphorus on the right that was done in the CAMU. Next slide, Monique. I've got some photos here of our sifting plant. Up at the top, there's our 3-acre sift plant. Basically, the process goes from right to left. And the photo there on the right, you'll see our Grizzly sifter. That's where the loader dumps the material in from the hazardous waste management unit, and it starts in the process. The photo in the bottom middle is our sifter shaker, which processes all the material through the various conveyors. We've got two pick lines there that you see in white up on the top there where we have ordnance techs working. The next feature is on the left there. We have 3 orange eddy currents, which processes the non-ferrous metals. That's about the last step in the process of the sifting plant. From there, on the far left, you'll see some piles of dirt. And that's where we have to do our soil sampling in order to meet our RCRA permit requirements. So with that, I will turn it over to John Jackson.
Hi, my name's John Jackson. I'm a geophysicist with the Ranch Support Center. Today I'm actually subbing in for Kathy Green, who's the Army Corps Environmental Project Manager, and Guy Ramine is the Remedial Project Manager at Marine Ocean Terminal Concord, or MOTCO, which is located just outside of Concord, California. In addition to being a massive coordination effort between all the various stakeholders, the remedial investigation is focused on one of our more notable historical events, the Port Chicago explosion. I encourage all of the history buffs in attendance to read up on all the extensive history of the event, but long story short, a cargo vessel full of approximately 5,200 barrels of heavy fuel oil and 4,600 tons of explosives detonated on July 17, 1944. This resulted in the killing of 320 people, most of which were African-American sailors, and is considered one of the key events leading to the desegregation of the military. On the next slide, the estimated explosive radius, or the MRS boundary, is shown on the upper left-hand corner. The field work is being performed by Parsons. It has been carried out in 3 phases, with phase 1 including the airborne performed by Patel, ground and underwater performed by ASI. The phase 2 is the intrusive investigation over the terrestrial areas, and phase 3 is the underwater intrusive investigation. As if the airborne and underwater geophysics weren't cool enough, the underwater intrusive investigation is being carried out by a crane-mounted magnet on a barge, which, to my knowledge, is one of the first times this type of work has been carried out. Munitions debris and mech have been successfully removed from the surface of the ocean floor in the effort to characterize the site. And now that I've related Black History Month and geophysics in the same slide for possibly the first time ever, I'll turn it over to Jim.
Good morning, all. I'm Jim Mostering. I'm project manager with the Sacramento District and the Range Support Center. What I wanted to do today was bring to your attention the 2012 effort that the Range Support Center undertook at Camp Beal, a formerly used defense site, to test out and learn how to contract this classification methodology and put it into production mode. With that, I'll go to the next slide. Of course, that's our goal, and that's the words of it. We're simplified to try to get this to a marketplace, and this was our first study, and there are ongoing efforts, I guess, at West Mesa that you heard about in the last M2S2, and soon to be done at performed at Camp San Luis Obispo, and John Jackson will be presenting that project later on today. So next slide. Formerly used defense site of Camp Beale is a very large area, 64,000 acres, roughly, multiple overlapping ranges, and it was actually initially used in one of DOD's Environmental Security Technology Certification Program studies, and part of that acreage that was a detection survey was done but not carried forward was the basis for some conversation between the CX, the Range Support Center, and the regulatory agencies, and we took that effort and parlayed it into a pilot study for this classification, and I'll go to the next slide. There's a picture of the 50 acres that ESTCP had originally done their detection survey on and some of the grids that they used, and ours were intermixed with that. It's a wooded area. We did two of the instrumentations, the metal mapper and the TEMTABS, and next slide, please. Those are the field sites of both pieces. Next slide. And borrowing a phrase from our legal counsel, the bottom line at the bottom, this is a very quick overview of results that shows that we did quite well. We were able to leave over 90% of the anomalies in the ground as non-targets of interest. And the regulatory agency has been very supportive and provide excellent reviews. And we're anticipating full concurrence at some point. And with that, I think that's about the last of it. Next slide. There we go.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about our Range Support Center and some of the projects we're doing, Duane. If anybody has any questions about some of the projects we discussed today, I have added a slide that has the POCs who discussed the project. With that, back to you, Duane.
Pretty good. Thank you, Monique, and all of the Range Support Center folks. That was quite good, especially considering the duress that some of y'all are having to present from a fire drill evacuation. That was admirable in overcoming adversity. So my hat's off to you. And actually, we do have a couple of minutes that we could probably field some questions. And one of the questions that we received, James, was related to your material on Fort Ord. And the question was, are there any local regulations or public resistance about the controlled burns that were being conducted out there?
Unfortunately, James has left, so I will try and answer on his behalf. And there is a very concerned citizens group there that is actively involved.
Well, since James left, I mean, we had kind of a follow-up question also about the burns, but I think I'll hold that until the open session when hopefully he can rejoin us. Here's a question, Steve Smith for Fort Wingate. How long did it take to get the record permit modified to accommodate or add in the CAMU?
Well, that's a good question. That was a Class 3 permit mod, and the process took about 2 to 3 years. It was not a... on one hand, it was you're digging a berm with so you can put some detonation pits and a burn pan in. It's real simple to do, but all the legal work and the permitting and the public notice and the consultation with the stakeholders, the EPA, the state, it took quite a bit of time. And we had to explore other alternatives as well, and we found that the stakeholders and the regulatory community they accepted us to use corrective action management units. So we did mod the permit, and there's stipulation, including the design, to do it in. And we also, fortunately, we had a significant input from our ordnance and explosive safety specialist. Jim Hugg and Steve Carpenter had a significant input to that permit mod.
Okay. But still a pretty arduous process in working it through the pipeline, basically, right?
Yeah, it was paperwork, submitting, and you know, corrections, modifications, changes here and there. But the duration of the time it take between submittals and then time it took the regulators to go through their processes of notification and public meeting if one was needed. Fortunately, we didn't have to have one.
Okay.
But it can be done.
Okay. I think I have time for maybe one, possibly two more questions, but this also relates to Fort Wingate, Steve. Is the munitions being removed from Fort Wingate, is that a hazardous waste?
Is it hazardous waste? Yes, when you are excavating it due to reactivity, the munitions are reactive. And so we are not removing hazardous waste from Fort Wingate. The actual corrective action management unit is less than a mile away from our hazardous waste management unit. We cited the corrective action management unit in a solid waste management unit, another RCRA term. So we're actually not removing much of any hazardous waste from Fort Wingate,
an anonymous participant has left the conference.
Unless we count the ash from the burns, and that could be hazardous due probably to metals.
Okay, gotcha. All right, very good. Well, thanks, Steve, and again, you know, to all of the Range Support Center folks. Monique, y'all did a good job of providing an overview for, again, some of the unique features of the Range Support Center. I think we had a couple more questions, but I think we're going to have to save those until the end when we have our open question and answer session. And so, you know, at this time, as Gene alluded to earlier, you know, we were going to try to do a video. We're going to try to play a movie today. So, you know, and this is to get us started on our technical presentations. We're going to show this short video that I think should underscore some of the key points about our theme for today's webinar. Now, you know, for those of y'all who are streaming the audio through your computer for the webinar, you should be able to hear the audio for the video through your computer, although you may need to turn the volume up just a bit. Anyone who dialed in on the phone conference line, however, you're not going to be able to hear the audio, but you should still be able to follow along. And we'll be posting a link for this video on the webinar's resources page. So if you had any trouble viewing it real time, or if you want to go back and check it out, you'll be able to do so. Gene, did I leave anything out on the mechanics of the video?
No, Duane, I think you've gotten that. In just a moment, we'll click play, and the audio should play back online, coming from their computer or mobile devices. If you're having any problems, I will have an alternative URL that I can share with people so that you can play it back after the live delivery on your own computer again.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and show it then. Excellent.
Here it comes.
Yeah, Secretary of State, now that's a kick-ass job right there. You really, I mean, that's like the person that's got to go around and hold hands with everybody.
I guess we're not going to walk musket tonight. No, we're doing it in the dark, right? Hey, Uncle Duane, you going to give this stuff to musket?
Yeah, I'm going to clean the meat off the buns first. Tell you what, why don't you go get the rest of the dishes for us and get those cleaned up, too.
Okay.
Come on, take it. the nightstand and see if my wedding band is up there?
Seconds here to make sure the video is playing back for those that might have different playback speeds. If anybody had any problems playing or watching that movie back online, you can use the Q&A window in the lower right-hand corner, and I'll give you an alternative URL that you can use to watch it back offline. And with that, Dwayne, feel free to go ahead and go on.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks, Gene. Yeah, some of y'all may experience a couple of buffering problems. I did on my end, and a lot of that, you know, may be due to your own personal computer or the network connection or whatever. But again, there will be a link for it. A couple of quick notes about the video. First, I just want to make it abundantly clear that not a single dime of government funding went into producing the video. We put it together entirely on personal time and with personal equipment. I've got a nephew of Paxton Farrar who's getting ready to graduate from NYU with a degree in film and television. And Paxton was down visiting with the rest of the family at Thanksgiving. And I told him about this idea I had for a little training video. And he was really grooving on the concept. So, you know, we went to work storyboarding and then filming it over the Thanksgiving weekend. Paxton did most of the editing and production over winter break. And we thought this would be a good venue for the world premiere. I don't know if Paxton was able to join the webinar. He had a class schedule conflict. But, hey, if you're out there, Paxton, a big shout-out to you. And I thought this video was a good segue into today's technical presentations. You know, up until recently, our industry's default paradigm has been to dig everything. But really, you know, with the size of the task before us, you know, we're simply not going to be able to make meaningful headway on the munitions contamination problem if we continue with that type of approach. You know, but now we are starting to field some really good tools which make it unnecessary to dig everything. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Herb Nelson. Herb is, CERTIP and ESTCP, and Herb has been a stalwart contributor to these forums and is one of the founding fathers of advanced classification. So, Herb, give us an update on the latest developments in advanced classification.
Great. Thank you very much, Dwayne. I appreciate it. As you will see, many of you will see on this first slide, I've listed my email address.
An anonymous participant has joined the conference.
I've been a very tough person to get in touch with the last 6 months. I've had three email addresses, but I'm back to my NRL address if you need to get in touch with me. So let's get started. As Dwayne said in his introduction, we've really made a lot of progress in the last year or so, and I think the last I updated this group at a M2S2 webinar just under a year ago. So in that year, we've spent a lot of time moving away from research and development and more toward production-type uses of these instruments and these procedures. And that's going to be important, of course, because our demonstration project will be over in about a year from now. So we've really got to work toward the end. So as you will see as we talk here, I am going to talk a little bit about the sensor hardware stuff that we've done in the last year or so, a very brief discussion of the analysis software and what's going on in that, and then I'm going to spend the last a third or 40% of the talk talking about some QC and QA tools that we've been developing over the last year, and then walk us through an example workflow, which obviously is not meant to be prescriptive, but just some things that we've been thinking about here at Certip and ESDCP. So let's get started with these deployments of the advanced sensors. I know many of you have seen and a lot of the core people use on their opening slide a picture of the metal mapper being deployed at San Luis Obispo with a nice little sunroof, sun awning on the top. Obviously, that was a pretty straightforward and easy field to work in. In the real world, we're going to have to work in a lot harder field. And this is some of the things that we've done recently to make this to work in tougher environments. In fact, you'll see here the at Hawthorne Army Depot just recently, it's very soft sand and ended up having to be a track vehicle to make the thing work. We've also worked in a lot tougher environments at MMR and Seibert where there's a lot of trash and stuff on the ground that may make that tractor a little hard to use. Stepping along to the TEMTEDS 2x2, which is the next size smaller and more mobile system, you can see that it can work in the upper right on this slide at the New Boston Air Force Station. That's a pretty, that's almost a golf course. But it is equally well worked at Spencer in the trees and most recently in the upper left of this slide in at Fort Bliss, where you can see that's pretty rough ground and everyone had, and it had to be deployed using a litter carry method. So we've got two people carrying the litter and one carrying behind with the control computer on his back. So they were able to go in very tough conditions using the litter carry method. And then finally, as we come down in size and up in portability comes the man-portable vector sensor, the so-called MPV, and you can see that this system is able to work in pretty dense woods. Obviously, nobody can work in the Amazon jungle, but in pretty dense woods, and is able to be used in either dynamic mode, meaning walking survey lines, as you can see in the top two pictures, or in the bottom picture, in queued, going back to a previously identified anomaly and gathering some more data on. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that as I move along. We've used, up until about a year or year and a half ago, we've used these sensors in really two-pass mode. Some sensor, and primarily it had been an EM61, would do a full coverage digital survey of the digital geophysical mapping survey of the field and identify anomalies for later queued coverage by these advanced sensors. So two passes, identify anomalies with one sensor, go back and look at these in a static or queued mode. We've made a lot of progress in the last year on doing dynamic identification surveys using the advanced sensors. And on this slide, you see one of the things that we get out of that. Obviously, many of you have heard talk about the sort of purple blobs that you get in an EM61 survey. And that, of course, is a consequence of the EM61 is a meter wide. And even though it's only half a meter down track, it's got a noise reduction time constant on it that makes it effectively about a meter down track. So you smear out the signals in a dense area, just like you see in that picture on the left-hand side. But as you notice, if we use the advanced sensors, Metal Mapper in the center or the TEMTEDS 2x2 on the right, that we get much better definition in the dense area. Obviously, there will always be some places at target center, particularly of a heavily used target, for which the anomalies are so dense that no sensor can break them apart. But the further we can go to breaking them apart, most of you know that if we use an EM61 sensor, we would have to draw a polygon around that densely part of the area and just go in and dig everything. So there may be a little polygon area in the middle of the metal mapper, but probably not at all in the TEMTEDS 2x2. We can probably address all of those as individual anomalies, which is a much more efficient way to do the intrusive investigation. So not only do you break these so-called purple blobs apart, but we get much better localization of the anomaly position using these advanced sensors. So there's a lot of stuff on this slide, and I made a mess out of them because all the numbers in the table are centimeters, and I forgot to write that on the slide. But you'll notice that comparison on the left is at the Spencer, former Spencer target area, comparing the M61 to the TemTads 2x2, and you can see that on average, the offset between the known QCCs and the reported position by the sensors is about half. The average offset is about 27 centimeters, so that's something like a foot for the M61, but it's half of that for the TemTads. And even at the worst case, it's half of it. The same thing turns out on the right. This is from former Camp Ellis, EM61 compared to Metal Mapper in this case. And you can see the same about half applies. So we get a lot better localization of the anomalies, which may lead us to these three bullets below here. We probably need to rethink the acceptable offset that we're willing to pay for. It definitely, if we can get a better number like we can from these dynamic sensors, it does a lot toward addressing these last two bullets, which makes the intrusive investigation and the acute investigation that we have to do one more efficient, and it definitely helps us not go to the wrong target. So here's a graphic example. Some folks like tables, some people like graphic things. Here's the blow-up out of one of those areas, and this on the left is the classic problem one gets with an EM61, a long, skinny target like this 2.36-inch rocket. You end up with peaks corresponding to the front and the back of the target, when in fact the rocket itself is under that circle, so is in the middle. Oftentimes the dig crew will have to go to the right side and the left side. Eventually they find the thing in the middle. Whereas with the advanced sensors, this is Metal Mapper, the same thing happens with TemTads. You see that the peak is right over the top of the anomaly, and we can go out and much more quickly recover what we're looking for. So those are some of the field procedures, field update improvements that we've made, moving toward tougher environments, moving toward using the advanced sensors for dynamic or detection surveys. We've also been working on the sensors themselves. We spent a lot of time in the last year working on in-field QC so that the field crew can be more confident that they're going to return with valid data, so we spend less time going back in the field and recollecting. And we've also got a project that I'm just going to touch on briefly with Geometrics, who is the manufacturer of Metal Mapper. And they're making they have a project to both ruggedize and standardize the Metal Mapper, which I think will pay dividends as we go forward. So here's an example from the TemTads, where this is the operator's view on the small tablet that the operator is holding when they run TemTads. You can see that there are integrity lights for the GPS and IMU string. There are some statistics on the quality of the GPS and IMU strings. Everything to let the operator know that everything's working when they collect their data. If we go to the next slide after the data are collected, there's also an in-field inversion button. We can look at where the target was compared to the sensor. In this case, they did a very good job. They're almost exactly on top of it, only 8 centimeters away. And this, of course, would inoculate us against recollects. If we find out that we were 30 or 40 or 50 or even more than that centimeters away from the center of the target, we may have to go back. We can also look at the drive polarizabilities. In this case, it's a very clean target, and all of you will recognize this as a cylindrical object. The signal noise is very high. I think this turns out to be a 37 millimeter projectile, but I'm not 100% sure of that. So, the other thing that we've worked hard on is a sensor function test. Many times people will take a half a day's worth of data and then find out that one of the coils in the TemTads or one of the cubes in the Metal Mapper stopped working. That's really frustrating for the field crew to have to go back and redo it again, plus it's not very monetarily efficient. So in the TemTads, they've implemented a system where a small ISO, one of the thick ones, is placed right in the center of the sensor. One collects a sensor function test, which compares the collected transients to something stored on the computer that was set up in the factory before it was sent out. And then you either get a simple green light pass or a red light fail if you do or do not match those. So some companies now are doing this every hour to make sure that everything's working. Certainly at a minimum, you want to do it a couple of times a day to make sure you weren't taking poor data that were not valid. Same sorts of things are being done on... Yes, ma'am.
Before you go any further, I apologize very much for interrupting. This is Jean Balance.
Sure.
We have had a technical glitch that did pop up, and we are going to likely restart the webinar in about 2 minutes.
Okay.
The system's going to do something. It's going to happen to everybody. If and when that does happen, the meeting should flash you a message that the session is going to be restarted. I've sent a message to all participants. Simply rejoin the webinar. We'll have it up and running in less than 30 seconds. I apologize profusely for this disruption. Dwayne will be able to revise the recording and repair it as well, but it will pop up a message if it closes. Just rejoin the webinar exactly the same way that you did. There's no need to modify anything. You'll be able to come right back in, and Herb, you'll be able to carry on where you left off. Keep going until you see the screen black out, and then I'll let you know what to do. Thank you again.
Okay, just before the interruption, then I had described the QC, infield QC things, and I had illustrated them with some examples from the TimTad system, but these very same things are being done to support Metal Mapper data collection, and I think all four of the Metal Mappers at the Corps of Engineers owns have had this installed. And you can see in the bullets on the bottom of this slide, you get position check, you get a green light if everything's working. All, as I said, oriented toward making sure the data collected in the field are valid. So I will get started talking about the updates from Geometrics. If I have to come back and talk to you guys about this in a few minutes, we'll fill it back in. So we have a project started, as I said earlier, to ruggedize and standardize the EM61. Sorry, I lost my pointer there. And that is based on both hardware improvements, and of course those of you that have used the Metal Mapper know that there's some room for that, and also simplifying and making more robust the software. And those of you who have struggled with that, particularly the Windows issues in the Metal Mapper, will know that that's required. And I have a little mistake in this build. We found out that, in fact, it's not summer fall, but we just heard at a program review last Wednesday, not in time to get these slides updated, that, in fact, the new version expected in fall-winter. I think Geometrics really has an incentive to get this thing going because they're not selling any of the old ones once they announce the new ones. So, you know, it's in everybody's best interest to get this going. So I'm just going to step through one or two quick examples of things that are going on. There's a whole lot of things going on. We're putting the electronics, and we have gone to some standardized electronics instead of the sort of research and development lab electronics that were used originally. That should cut down the breakdowns and make it much easier to ruggedize it. We've gone to modern manufacturing practices for both the transmit and receive coils. I know many of you have experienced wires coming loose or connectors breaking on the current on the coils, and that's because they were wired up in the garage and not really tough enough to make it work in the field. So using modern manufacturing processes, I think we can cut down a lot the number of errors. And I think almost more importantly, and I alluded to this a minute ago, is a standardized but simplified software interface. Those of you that have used a Metal Mapper know that it was really optimized for a demonstration system. The operator had the ability to change almost every parameter in the data collection and in the every parameter possible in the Metal Mapper system, which is great for finding the sweet spot. But once you found the sweet spot, too many knobs lets people wander into places they ought to not be unknowingly. So there will be a very simplified set of automatic reminders for background measurements, a lot more icons, a couple of simplified parameter inputs with recommendations defined for you, and the data will be stored in an open source format that will be accessible to all rather than the proprietary format that is currently stored. So this is really the money slide here, and it's not as good a news as we would all. Heads is equally in short supply. There's about six of those now. The Navy has one that they use exclusively in the Vieques project, and so far I've had good luck with it. The rest of them are at the Naval Research Lab, where I actually work, and they are also being supplied as government-furnished equipment on projects as required. A couple of commercial projects have been done with them, mostly ESDCP demonstrations. Within a year, these will be available for purchase from Geometrics, which will up the reliability of the supply chain and everything from the demonstration project it is. The real problem is the last big bullet, which is the MPV. My friend Brian Hari told me the other day that if you go to the field, two sensors equals one and one equals none. So I guess the MPV has almost none because there is only one of those, and if it breaks, it breaks. So we are working on a transition for that. One thing that will facilitate that transition is the Geometrics new electronics box, which you talked about three or four slides before the interruption, will work with the MPV. So once one owns a box for a Metal Mapper or a TimTads, one could also apply it to an MPV. Okay, so I'm going to now just very briefly talk about the software. Many of you have used UX Analyze. We've had 6 or 7 training sessions in the past. 200 people have been at these things, so a lot of you on the phone may have been at one of those. We've really made in the last 6 months now major improvements to the workflow in UX Analyze. What we found was that a not experienced analyst, a novice or a just learning analyst, really was overwhelmed by the workload, and even more than that, was overwhelmed by the information flow. I think we've all experienced it. When you're at the end of a fire hose, it's pretty tough to pay attention. You're just fending off the water. So we've tried to cut that down and free up time for the operator to look at the things that are important. And hopefully, you see on the bottom bullet here, as we start training for this next month, or exits next month plus 3 days, we can really start to swing this out for the whole community. Right now, it's been released to power users. I saw a demonstration of it last Thursday, and it was actually quite attractive. I'll show you a few of the features here. Oh, I'm sorry, an interruption here. Just to let you know, the UX Analyze is a module that is integrated in Oasis Montage, which I think most people in the industry use. It is built toward classification only, and if you own Montage, this module is released to you free of charge, being paid for by ESCCP. Okay, now let's get on to the thing. So we've really tried to structure the software in terms of these 5 big tasks that one does, and all of you that have done classification will recognize all of these. Obviously, the bottom line is this task here, prioritize. We've got to do all of that to get there. And as we do that, we've really, as I said, cut the load on the operator. Here is all a listing of all the steps that one used to do all of this. And now all of that is collapsed into just those 5 big tasks that I talked to you about. A lot of the stuff's going on behind the scenes is hidden from the operator, and the operator is only presented with QC views that they really need to focus on for the difficult cases. Okay, so that is the update. Let's do 2 things now. We'll talk a little bit about QC and QA tools that we are developing, some at CERTIP and ESDCCP, some in conjunction with other people. They're the 2 primary things are listed on this slide. I'm going to walk through both of those. And then when we're finished with that, I'm just going to take 5 minutes or so, and I have to watch my time because I have a little interruption. I'm just going to take 5 minutes or so and walk through what I think is a workflow and the kind of products you might be generating to share with your stakeholders, and if you're a stakeholder, the type of products you might want to see. So let's first talk about this UFP QAP. I'll tell you all in advance that I spent a lot of time in speech therapy when I was a child, and it mostly worked, but I do not say words that start with Q very well, so no matter what you think you're hearing me, I'm saying QAP. For Quality Assurance Project Plan. So ESCCP, in conjunction with the California DTSC, had developed a draft QAP. And I think it's pretty good, but we're certainly not experts in the QAP business. So we have handed this draft, or I think they would probably say a working draft, no more than that, off to a work group of the Intergovernmental Data Quality Task Force. And their job is to finalize and then promulgate this. We've got our first kickoff meeting of this work group is tomorrow afternoon, so we're ready to get going on this. The goal is to take this QAP and field test it this summer at the San Luis Obispo demonstration that John Jackson is going to talk about in the talk right after this. So those of you that are experts in this area, and I'm certainly not one of those, will see that we've included these worksheets in our draft. Obviously, the quality assurance project plans were originally oriented toward laboratory sampling, traditional chemical cleanup, so there are a number of the worksheets that don't really apply to munitions. I think the Environmental Data Quality Work Group of DOD thinks that we left out a couple that we needed to include, but so here's where we are now. We've also put together a large number of SOPs to go with to accompany this document, and as you see, They're built around the mental mapper, but they really are meant to be beginning to end of the project. Now, obviously, nobody wants to read this whole list in any detail, and even worse, you don't want to read these SOPs. But I'll show you that they break down into the five or six real functional subcategories that we showed on the earlier slides in the analysis software. There's a number of pre-survey operations, assembling the mental mapper when it comes off the truck, making sure it works, getting the area seeded with QCCs. There's a number involving collection of geophysical data. There are a number associated with extracting parameters from those geophysical data that will allow us to make decisions about buried objects. There are some for the classification itself, which is making the decision about these buried objects. And then finally, there's some QA-oriented SOPs, which allow us to determine whether we did a quality project and whether it's acceptable to all stakeholders. Okay, so let me finish up now with just walking through quickly an example workflow. If you look on the left, you ought to recognize all of those steps. This is the two-path version that I talked about earlier, where there's a separate detection survey, then a queued survey. But if we did it all in one, we just combine two or three of those boxes. I think everybody on this call, knows more about the planning process through the work plan than I do, so I'm not going to talk about that. You'll just have to, if I gave you advice, it would probably be bad advice. So I'm going to pick up when we start field work, and I want to really emphasize that the first thing we're going to do is a surface sweep, and I think we really should be paying hard attention to this because this is the cheapest and easiest way to handle an anomaly. You can pick it, a sweep team can pick something up off the surface a lot less expensively than it would take to collect data and classify it. So we want to get rid of all surface anomalies we can right away. We then, of course, will get started with the advanced sensor survey. This will be familiar to many of you. It's the traditional GSV process, where we make sure the sensor's working, where we visit the instrument validation strip, the IVS, to make sure that the sensor's working. We may or may not settle on a final detection threshold based on some noise, based on some site noise that we find there. All of these things on the right are, I'm suggesting, would be outputs that would come from this. These three reports would come from this and would allow us all to agree to proceed with the project. When we're working on the detection survey, this will just follow the standard practices that everybody does today, where there's weekly QC reports and data reports. Obviously, the QC geophysicist will be checking for the QA seeds to make sure that those are being detected. At the conclusion of the detection survey, just like today, we would have a final anomaly list, but of course, instead of digging them all in a classification project, we're going to go make a decision on them all. So we would set up our queued sensor, take it to the IVS to make sure the queued sensor is working. In this case, of course, I've implicitly assumed that the detection sensor and the queued sensor are different physical objects, but they could be the same sensor. So we're back to the IVS for the queued sensor. Once we've established that it's working, get the go-ahead to start field work, we go into our normal loop again. Each week, there's a QC report turned into the Corps, or if it's the Navy, the third-party QA person. We get a data report. We're checking to make sure the QA seeds are being correctly classified so we can apply corrective action if some errors are cropping up. When we get to the conclusion of the queued survey, now we're going to submit a report where we decide how we're going to do the classification, what thresholds we're going to use, what are the features that we're going to use. We put together a dig list, and I'm imagining a small report that lays out the rationale for why we did the first two in a report. This, I think, will be important to share with the stakeholders as we want to get everybody on board. Then we go out and dig. And at the conclusion of the intrusive work, digging all the ones we recommended to dig, we will be turning in, you the contractors will be turning in, we the government will be receiving the final dig report results, of course, justification for why the stop dig point was correctly chosen, and maybe some recommendations for validation digging. What can we do to QA to be sure that the stop dig point was reliable? And now we're almost done. The government prepares a final validation plan. As I talk to regulators and am involved with the ESCCP advisory group with regulators, the way that group is going is to test each decision threshold to make sure that we use the right threshold and then do some random testing of non-TOI just to make sure that the inversion results are coming out. We're obviously not going to be able to randomly sample and find the one munition we may have missed, but we want to get confidence in the process through these random digs. We'll do the validation digs, And I'm assuming there's going to be no surprises because this stuff works well. So that means the project's complete. So that also means that my presentation is complete. I have up here the link for more information. It's also can be found in the first item in the related, URLs on the right side of the screen. And I don't really know how long much time I have left because the clock reset itself and all of that business, but be happy to take some questions if there is some time.
Well, Herb, you you did really well in moving through that material, even with the reset. We have we do have a few moments here for questions for you. So, first question that came up was, how many live site demonstrations are planned for this year, and how many for next year?
Oh, that's a very good question. We have done 20 to date. We think we have funding. This is the last year of the program. Fiscal year 14 is the last year of the program, but we're behind on execution because of the funding delays accompanied by sequestration. So we really will not finish the work through 15. So the question is exactly right. We're looking to do 6 or maybe 7 this year and then finish up with maybe 3 more next year.
Okay. So it's wrapping up the next year, okay? I'm not sure I realize that.
This is sort of my last year in this, so it was nice talking to all you guys.
Well, we've got our hooks in you now, Herb. You're in for life now. So, okay, another quick question. Are the co-op and SOPs available to everybody? And if so, where could we get copies?
Well, I think, you know, in theory they are available, but in practice they have not yet been. The way this has worked is we put together a little committee to draft them up. Obviously, some of those SOPs, I don't know how to do it, so I can't write an SOP. And then we circulated that for comment to our advisor group and have now transitioned it to the work group of this IDQTF, Intergovernmental Data Quality Task Force. I think that they would like to wait 3 or 4 months and let them bless them before they are promulgated. When they are, they will be on their website and obviously each of the services. I assume we'll post them on theirs. I know the Navy is going to post it on their Navy portal.
Okay. All right. Y'all, you're not planning on having them on y'all's portal, though, correct?
Well, I guess they would be, yes. I mean, they would be on ours, but I assume that the average PM, or, you know, the Navy calls them RPM, would get them through their normal chain where they get all of their information.
Right, right. Okay. Good, good. Herb, do you foresee a need for many MPV-sized sensors?
Well, I think so. I'm going to base this on the experience we've had over the last 6 months at Waikoloa Maneuver Area. We started doing a demonstration out there. Let me take a sidebar and make sure everybody on this call knows that there is a huge liability at Waikoloa, and anything we could do to help them is would be valuable. But it's a very difficult site because it's very, very responsive soil there. The lava makes a mess out of the response of these sensors. We started with a metal mapper, and we're only able to cover a small fraction of the area. It's a very difficult terrain also. And so not being satisfied with that, we just concluded a survey where we sent the MPV back, and they were able to cover 100% of the area, the grids that they were working in. So that's such a big project, you can imagine 5 or 6 of them being used at Waikoloa itself. And obviously the closer you come to the East Coast, the more there are trees and forests, and the more it's not metal mapper on a tractor, but an MPV in a person's hand.
Right, right. Yeah, I can imagine out there at Waikoloa that, just even the topography.
Yeah, at Waikoloa it's tough to walk on some of those sites, much less carry a sensor and walk.
Right, exactly. Okay. A couple more questions I believe we have time for. How do you determine the non-target of interest to dig? Is there any standard way to do it?
Well, yeah, that is sort of the question of the day, so good job whoever asked that question. I have my ideas, but I'm not king, and so it's not clear that my ideas will rule. It is certainly the case that everyone we talk to that is a regulator or site owner or something wants right now confirmation that we've chosen the threshold to stop digging correctly. So they always want to dig the next 20 on the list, and I just made that number up, 20 or 25 or something. But they all fear that we were a little too aggressive in our stop dig point and we just missed something. So I think we will always dig just past the threshold. I'm a big advocate then of just randomly choosing a dozen or two out in what will be the green part of the rock curve or the things that you've said not to dig. And I just want to make sure that we've correctly predicted the size and shape of what we dug, what we didn't dig, to show the stakeholders that our methods are working and we think they're clutter and here's why, and we dig them up and they are clutter.
Gotcha. So there's the buffer of the almost made the cut list that the team would work through, and then what you're saying is a random set after that to verify to boost the confidence.
Yeah, well, that's what makes me feel good. But you know, I think each PM is going to have to think about what makes their own team feel good and arrive at this. Obviously, when we get some more experience with this, there will become standard ways that everybody can agree to accept. But right now, you know, we're making it up as we go along. So I think it is site-by-site dependent right now.
Okay, good. We had a question came in that, do you have plans to make the classification software available to the regulatory agencies without having to purchase a GeoSoft license?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry. Because I don't really know the details of what fraction of the total GeoSoft license, which obviously many people on this call know are quite expensive, is required to do UX analyze. Let me put that on the to-do list, and the next time I talk to the team, I'll figure this out.
Okay. Very good. Well, we weren't asking the question to give you taskers there, Herb, but we appreciate it. Hey,
well, you know, we say here at ESCCP, we live to serve, so ask
there
away.
There you go. Hey, is there any size criteria for the MD, for the metal that you're recovering and the surface removal?
Well, there certainly needs to be. John will tell you in a minute that at the San Luis Obispo demonstration, the performance work statement says, I believe, 1 inch on a side. Obviously, anything that is substantial that will be chosen in the detection survey, that's what I would like to get off the field. So I guess if you're looking only for large, deep airdrop bombs, you don't have to worry about it too much. And if you're looking for 20 millimeters, you're in big trouble because almost everything has to come off the site. So probably it depends on the targets of interest.
Okay, good. Makes sense. One last question. Can I start digging before I'm done queuing?
I think so. I would, you know, I know, and I shouldn't say you know because not everyone on this call knows, the ESCCB demonstrations are very limited scope. We, in general, do 2,000 or 1,500 or 2,500 at the most anomalies, so we are able to have the luxury of doing this sequentially, detect, queue, dig. In a large project that has tens of thousands or more anomalies, obviously you don't have that luxury, and it's not efficient of the team. So I would imagine one would go across the site digging as you worked. You might have to be a little conservative in your thresholds in the beginning, and as you got smarter and smarter about the site as you went, you'd probably be tightening up your thresholds by the end.
Excellent. Very good. Well, Herb, as always, very nice presentation, excellent information. Really, really appreciate it. Okay, well, and at this time, you know, if you have, if anyone out there has additional questions for Herb or his presentation material, again, we will have a Q&A session, an open session at the end of all of the presentations. So please feel free to send any questions you might have in. But at this time, we're going to move on to our next presentation, and this is going to be given to us by John Jackson. John's a geophysicist out at the Corps of Engineers District, working with the Range Support Center, the design center out there, and he's going to be covering a case study that Herb even mentioned a few minutes ago, the San Luis Obispo, and he's going to be touching on some of the contracting issues associated with the advanced classification. John's worked with geophysics and munitions projects for a number of years now, and he's also, you know, one of the participants with the live site demonstrators with some of Herb's projects. So, John, I'm going to let you have the floor.
Thank you, Dwayne. Unfortunately, I have the pleasure of talking to you not only from a park bench, but I also get to follow Herb's enthusiastic talk with quite possibly the driest material a geophysicist can talk about, contracting. But really, we can only blame ourselves, because pretty much every meeting, conference, or informal conversation, I always overhear the same variation, or some variation of the same question: when will we see production-level contracts from the metal mapper? So today I would like to walk you through a recent request for proposal. This was issued through the Los Angeles District for a treatability study at Camp San Luis Obispo. It was to utilize advanced sensors for production level work. First, I would like to take you through a little bit of the site history and intent of the treatability study at Camp SLO before I get to the really dry stuff and walk you through the RFP and PWS. And Gene, or whoever's controlling the slides, I still don't have control, so I'm moving to slide 3. Camp SLO is a formerly used defense site located approximately 6 miles northwest of the city of San Luis Obispo. At one time, it occupied almost 15,000 acres of beautiful coastal rolling hill terrain. Shown on this figure are the areas of the recent remedial investigation covered, which was MRS's 01, 02, and 05. It totaled just over 2,500 acres. I, of course, printed my slides in black and white, but I believe MRS 01 is in light blue, MRS 02 is in purple, and MRS 05, which is of concern today, is green. And based on the RI, this MRS has actually been proposed to be split into separate MRSs. Moving to slide 4. Camp SLO was initially established as a National Guard camp in 1928. Like many of our FUD sites, it expanded from 5,800 acres to almost 15,000 acres in World War II. Some of the land was actually transferred back directly after World War II before being retaken by DOD during the Korean War. But after the Korean War, the land was finally transferred to a variety of private owners, most of which, though, went to educational purposes, being Cal Poly and Cuesta College, and the original 5,800 acres was retained by the California National Guard. As you can see from this list, the FUD site has a long history of investigations, and this would be the FUD site as a whole, not specifically MRS 05. But the most notable for today is the TICRA in 2010 that was on the eastern portion of MRS 05 and the ESTCP demonstration that was in 2009. Moving to slide 5, the site is currently in the remedial investigation and feasibility study phase of the CERCLA process. The prime is Bristol, 8A out of Alaska, which subcontracted the geophysics to in-depth, and they have now completed the RI fieldwork, and they are currently finalizing the RIFS report. During the RI, approximately 4,000 anomalies, 3,200 munitions debris finds, and 13 mech were found on a transect-based investigation. You can see from the pictures here, we used EM61 across most of the hilly terrain, but there were some areas where it was analog only. Moving to slide 6, the RI helped revise the conceptual site model. Of importance to the treatability study are the munition types found, of which there are a large variety, and the depths at which the munitions were found. And the column on the right-hand side is the maximum depth recovered to date in centimeters. So a lot of these munitions are rather shallow, and that's because of the shallow bedrock at the site, through most of the site. It's important to note here that the chart actually represents the RI as a whole, or information up through the RI as a whole, and not necessarily the munitions found just at MRS 05 or the immediate area of the treatability study. Revising the CSM and smartly developing data quality objectives and remedial action objectives based on the CSM is of the utmost importance, and I would like to pause here and take this opportunity to refer you to the previous BlueIn webinar, where there were several excellent presentations on this topic. Moving to slide 7, here's a visual depiction of the munitions debris and mech across the site. I'm not sure if your eyes are good enough to read the details on this slide. Maybe you can zoom in. but the MD and MEC are pretty well spatially dispersed across the site. They're lower and higher densities, and based on those estimated densities that were created during the RI, we initially sought to place the treatability study in the general vicinity of the high-density area located in the center left of the ranges. I don't recall the color of the ranges, but it's about the intersection of the westernmost and central ranges. Moving to slide 8, as also discussed in the last DQO and RAO webinar, it's important to understand the current and future land uses prior to developing remedial action goals. For this particular site, we have the Cal Poly Agricultural School, and they use the site for cattle grazing and cattle studies. They also have used it for geotechnical classes in the past, which includes soil sampling. The Los Padres National Forest is on the north side of the site, and there are firearms ranges, shooting ranges on the western portion of the site, which they do host shooting events a few times a year where there is camping allowed. Not directly in the MRS, but may influence future decisions, are the San Luis Obispo Public School District and the El Choro Regional Park. Moving to slide 9, now that we have a good understanding of the site history up to this point, I'd like to walk you through the timeline of the treatability study. In the spring of 2013, ESDCP and USACE teamed up and agreed that Camp Slo would be an ideal site to explore additional advanced sensor and classification deployments. In June of 2013, ESDCP and USACE met with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC, to discuss project objectives. And I would like to pause here and take a moment to look at my asterisk, because it's an important one. We, at this meeting and to date, there was no final RIFS report, and there's no final decision document. But here we are making project objectives with the state, which if we again refer back to the last clue-in session, this was clearly stated on one of James Salisbury's slides as being a good idea and highly recommended. In September 2013, ESDCP and USACE collected some additional TEMDAS transects through two of the higher density areas depicted in the RI, and I'll have a slide later showing those transects. The intent behind this additional data collection was to, one, better define the RI data utilizing the advanced sensors, and also to pick up the most logical location for the treatability study. Moving to slide 10. In October 2013, USACE gave the green light and funded the project. December 15th, the RFP went out. The LA district borrowed capacity on the WERS contract out of Huntsville. The proposals were due January 10th because we wanted the contractors to work over the holidays. And we are anticipating a late February award with July 2014, we're still on pace to start the field work at that time. Moving to slide 11, the treatability study objective was developed at the meeting in June 2013. This is more or less the project objective that we agreed upon at that meeting. It has, of course, gone through the legalese rewording process. But at that meeting, and I think I have these highlighted in red, we agreed all other TOI meeting that detection threshold would also need to be detected. We agreed all non-TOI could be left in the ground. And most importantly, we agreed that the treatability could and would supplement the feasibility study. Earlier, I had said we had done the smart thing by revising the CSM and designing a project objective around that data. And here we have done just that. Additionally, all of the MEC found to date based on that chart on an earlier slide would be selected based on our detection threshold in this study objective. Moving to slide 12, and I think this has some sort of cool action, PowerPoint action on it. Just a quick break in the monotony for our visual learners. Another way to show this is our project objective means that all 37 millimeters need to be found at a foot. are detected down to a foot. And all of these other items on the right also need to be detected that are equivalent to that threshold, even if it means digging deeper than a foot or detecting data deeper than a foot. Moving to slide 13, just to summarize what we've done well so far, is we've engaged the state early on during the pre-planning process. We've developed initial data quality objectives. We've collected new data at the site utilizing the advanced sensors. We've modified the treatability site location based on that data. And then we've also developed an initial government estimate of roughly 15,000 anomalies across the 7 acres. And this was based on detection only, then it's detection of that threshold of the 37 at 30 centimeters. So we know there's more small stuff out there, and we also know there is room for improvement on these estimates using better classification and selection processes. Moving to slide 14, if you'll recall, I stated earlier that our intent of the additional transects included picking the most logical location for the treatability study. Well, in this case, the most logical location fell right on the side of a hill. There's a polygon on this figure. I believe it's in very, very light blue. It's at the elbow of one of the transects. It is on a fairly arduous hillside. However, not only does it have the higher densities we're looking for this treatability study, but it is also representative of the terrain across the rest of the MRS. Just to further explain the slide a bit more, the more north-south or northwest-southeast transects are the RI transects, and the more east-west or northeast-southwest transects are the TEMTATS transects collected in September. The red stars are where MEC has previously been found. You'll note that none of the MEC found are in the actual treatability study area, but they have been found directly around the treatability study on the wider RI transects, and they were in lower estimated density areas, so we can safely assume we're in the right area. The pseudo-color imaging in orangish is the creek density estimates based on the TEMTATS data. Moving to slide 15. Now that we understand the intent of the treatability study, it's time to move on to the specifics of the performance work statement. In the PWS, we separated out all of the tasks, and I'm going to highlight what I believe are some of the key components of the tasks that may be a little different from traditional MMRP projects. So moving to slide 16. Task one assess, we actually, in a way, already began this at the June meeting when we sat down with the state, but we are emphasizing following the full TPP process. We've emphasized defining the project objectives and developing the data quality objectives to meet those objectives. We've emphasized developing the QAP content to meet those DQOs, and we've also introduced the concept of the verification or validation memo. And this will require initial development during the TPP process. And Herb highlighted that topic a little bit, but just to briefly explain it, the verification plan is to demonstrate beyond all reasonable doubt to the stakeholders that the classification scheme actually works. So this may likely include some additional digging of the non-targets of interest to quote-unquote prove that the process has worked. Moving to slide 17, in addition to the other planning documents that were required under Task 2, we also referenced the recent EM200-1-15 guidance that requires a UFP QAP. We provided a draft advanced classification QAP, which, as Herb also stated, it's being produced and looked after as a joint team effort. There's the task force he mentioned, along with ESTCP, some MMRP contractor, community members, DTSC, and USACE are all members of that team. And the Range Support Center and hopefully and likely other USACE design centers will utilize this Camp Slow QAP as the template for all future projects that involve advanced classifications. Slide 18, moving on to task 5. It's the QC blind seating. The minimum requirement of the 37 millimeter and the small ISO being blind seated were to ensure that a reasonable sample size of seeds relating back to the project objective could be achieved. This was the requirement for the QC seeding done by the contractor. This is separate from the government QA seeding that may be done out there. It requires that this QC blind seed plan be accepted by USACE ahead of time, and DTSC is provided the opportunity to have their input at both the TPP meetings and the UFP review of the UFP QAP stages. And then of utmost importance is the development of a blind seed firewall plan. Moving on to slide 19 is task 6, the detection survey. Of importance to the detection survey is the requirement to use advanced sensors, and I don't believe I've mentioned it yet to this point, but the advanced sensors are being provided as government-furnished equipment. Up to 2 metal mappers and 2 TEMTAD units will be made available for the treatability study. So here again, you see the project objective requirement of a 37 at a foot. Just like the GSV process, we're requiring an IVS memo to be submitted demonstrating a working instrument prior to the start of data collection. And then of specific interest to the advanced sensors is requiring each of the receiver's data to be resolved into separate database lines. Moving to slide 20 is task 7, the queued survey. The objective of the queued survey is to collect data on all the detected anomalies and correctly classify 100% of the TOI and 75% of the non-TOI. Visually, if you look to the rock curve on the right, where each correctly classified TOI moves you up vertically and each non-TOI moves you to the right, you can visually understand the project objective, where all of the TOI must fall in the red before you stop digging, and at least 75 of the clutter must be classified in the green. Keep in mind that because we're leaving metal in the ground, we will not actually have the results of that full green portion of the curve, so I think we need to start developing some examples of only partial rock curves to start educating ourselves and getting used to that image. And then finally on this one, the positioning requirements of the inverted seat locations were fairly strict, but should be easily obtainable under the guidelines of the queued survey. Moving to slide 21, we have an example conceptual site model that you may recognize from Andy Schwartz's presentation at the last Cluin seminar. I think he's showed it elsewhere. And I actually think it was developed by a team of other people that should receive credit, but I don't know their names. It is only an example, not related to the site, but I'm showing it here as a summary for what a good seeding plan and verification memo should address. If we have these munitions found at these depths, then the QC and verification plan should be able to demonstrate that the project objectives have been met, or even conversely, the projects can't be met, and this is a good visual of why. Moving to slide 22 and also 23, I don't want to spend a lot of time going through the key personnel requirements, but I do want to mention that we designated the project manager, Suxos, project geophysicist, field geophysicist as key personnel. Long story short, we are looking for a PDT with advanced classification experience, and based on the fact that the success hinges on the experience of the geophysicist, we're looking for quite a bit of experience and success at the project geophysicist level. The Suxos, we did not require advanced classification experience, but just the standard TP18 requirements, and then the field geophysicist should also have some directly relatable advanced EMI instrument experience. Slide 24, here we have the food pyramid of the evaluation factors. I apologize for the graphic, but I really had to get creative to come up with a way of making technical evaluation factors an interesting topic. At the bottom of the pyramid, or the two most important, were factor 1 and factor 2. Factor 1 was the technical approach methods and procedures. Factor 2 was the personnel experience. Below that in waiting was factor 3, corporate experience. Below that in waiting was factor 4 and 5, tied for mech safety methods and corporate management structure. And then last but not least was factor 6, which was the past performance criteria. Moving to slide 25, a little more detail on factor 1. The intent of the factors is to state how the proposals will be reviewed and what the government is looking for. For factor 1, we're looking for incorporation of all government-furnished data into the technical approach and understanding and ability to conduct a dynamic advanced sensor survey. Also the CUTE survey, of course. Some details on the proposed classification scheme. The technical approach needs to be transparent, founded on logic and physics, and is independently verifiable. The QC seeding plan should be discussed, and the verification plan should be discussed. For factor 2, this was on slide 26, this was primarily the experience of the personnel. Bullet number 3 sort of highlights we were looking for lessons learned while performing advanced geophysical sensors from the personnel. As well as on slide 27, we were looking for lessons learned for corporate experience as well. Moving to slide 28 is subfactor, and I believe it initially started out as 5C in the PWS, and then after amendment it became factor 5B. We were looking for a succession plan. Because the key component of success for the project was that the key personnel being proposed, we wanted a succession plan described of how these key personnel would be replaced. And the graphic isn't saying exactly what we're looking for, but we were looking for thought on picking who the replacement individual would be. And moving to slide 29, we had some lessons learned, and I didn't print this, but I believe we started with a project geophysicist definition. We did change that based on feedback. I will let you read for yourself what the new definition was. We changed the evaluation criteria for, as Herb mentioned, for the surface clearance. It was originally written in a fairly complicated way, and then after a colorful conversation with the OESS and feedback from multiple contractors, we did change it to something very simple, and off the top of my head, I can't remember if it was 1 or 2 inches in each dimension. We discovered that lessons learned was a very useful evaluation tool. We may expand that requirement in the future. We definitely appreciated the incorporation of government-furnished data. Looking back as a lesson learned for the Corps, using advanced sensor transects as a supplement to the already taken RI data was a great idea. It helped us move our site. I think it helped us develop better estimates and was probably, in the long run, a cost saver. Another lesson learned is there's always assumptions in everything that you do, and there's going to be even more as we evaluate something as complicated as advanced classification, and so we need to develop a way and methodology and contingencies to be able to handle those. So in summary, I think that it was overall a resounding success. It's clear that the advanced sensors will save DOD money in the long run and across many sites. And I think the Corps will have an excellent template to base all of the future advanced classification contracting questions. And I believe that is all of my slides. Thanks for dealing with me from a park bench. Feel free to ask any questions or email, or after all this is done, I'll hopefully be back at my desk.
Very good. Thanks, John. And again, kudos to you for operating in the hostile environment there. That's a good job of overcoming adversity. Excellent presentation. I loved the food pyramid analogy. That was quite excellent. We did have a couple of questions, and I think we have time for just a couple here. One is, you know, somebody wanted you to go into more detail about the colorful conversation that you had with the OESS, but maybe we shouldn't get into that here. We may lose our PG-13 rating, so I'll just skip over that one. But one of the questions we had was, under Task 7, what's the basis for the 75% non-TOI metric, and why is that important?
The basis of that is the whole point of advanced classification is to save DOD money. And the ability to leave metal in the ground is the ability to classify the non-TOI as non-TOI. So for this project, recent results have shown that 75% is easily attainable, and so we set that as a baseline threshold, but I wouldn't be surprised if we were able to get that to 90%.
Okay, very good. Now, earlier you mentioned, you know, when you say that the project objectives can't be met, can you elaborate about what you mean by that?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
When you say the project objectives cannot be met, can you elaborate what you mean about that?
Oh, I assume that's off my conceptual site model slide.
I believe that was correct.
We may have the very rare situation where for some reason 37s are being found at a meter and a half. We know that we cannot detect 37.5. So the CSM slide is a very good visual depiction that if you have 37s that deep, but you can only detect to 20 centimeters or 40 centimeters, then you're not meeting that project objective, and it may need to change, or you may need to find a different path to achieving that project objective.
Right. Perfect explanation. That's what we're looking for. Yeah. One more question, I believe, John, before we cut you loose there, or at least until the open Q&A session. What education, training, and experience is needed to be a qualified geophysical analyst?
That's probably the most important question of the hour, and we are all, as a community, working towards having a good answer to that question. And I wish we had a good answer, but probably the best answer to date is experience playing with the data, having gone through the process, and a third party validating your results is of the utmost importance. And that is what I would say qualifies you. And currently the way to do that is to have been an ESTCP demonstrator.
Okay, yep, the question of the day. That's excellent. All right, well, very good, John. We appreciate it. And again, see if they'll let you back in the building, and hopefully you'll be able to rejoin us for the open Q&A. But very much appreciate the excellent presentation. All right, well, at this time, we're going to break for our intermission, so everybody please go stretch, take a restroom break, get some refreshments, and we will see everybody back in 15 minutes. So at the top of the hour, we will resume. Thank you.
As Dwayne mentioned, we are currently on a short 15-minute a break. We're going to resume the live broadcast at 3 p.m. Eastern. During that break, there will be a counter up in the online environment. Our telephone lines will remain up. We will keep our online audio stream as well as the online room up and running. Participants are welcome to stay in, stay on the line, stay on the phones. And again, we'll just simply resume operations at 3 p.m. for today's webinar. If you need to close out or hang up, you can certainly do so. Just know we will be rejoining the broadcast promptly at 3 p.m. Eastern. While we're waiting, we will keep our Q&A window open in the lower right-hand corner. You can continue to submit questions, comments, or report technical issues in that lower right corner. We also will keep our interactive polls open in the lower left half of your screen. So if you haven't done so, please take a moment and share your vote favorite events at the Sochi Olympics, as well as, from your perspective, Exactly what do you think the limiting factor in moving advanced geophysics classification into commonplace utilization on munitions investigation is? And you can simply pick an answer from the options listed below. When we regroup today, we'll certainly take a moment to discuss some of the votes as they're coming in.
can get the price of 300.
Okay, I think that we are about ready to come back from break now.
Here.
Well, I hope everybody had a chance. I hope everyone had a chance to vote. We really were looking for your input on what you perceive might be some of the limitations for fielding advanced classification on your project. That's very useful info for us. Can help us tailor our efforts towards addressing some of those hurdles. And then, obviously, snowboarding and it looked like snowboarding and hockey were the runaway favorites from the Olympic event. Everything else was kind of an also-ran. But we're going to pick back up, and our next speaker is Elise Goggin. And Elise, She's been working with the Huntsville Center as a geophysicist for several years now, ever since she graduated from the Colorado School of Mines. And Elise, I guess for me personally anyway, one of the more impressive things about Elise is that she has an adventure coming up very soon, a rather large-scale adventure. I know many of y'all have probably heard of the Appalachian Trail, but the Pacific Crest Trail is also a long-distance trail. It's the Appalachian Trail's younger but bigger brother. It's a continuous footpath running from the border with Mexico to the Canadian border along the west coast. And Elise is going to be attempting a through hike of the Pacific Crest Trail. So I am very, very impressed with Elise and looking forward to following her on her journey remotely as she journals it. So, Elise, good luck on that. But before you get to do that, we want to hear you talk about advanced classification. So please take it away.
Thanks, Dwayne. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to my adventure, but still working now, so I guess I'll go ahead with this presentation. I'm going to be talking to you today about limiting factors and lessons learned dealing with classification. And I have to say, you guys have definitely asked some great questions so far, and I think you stole a little bit of the spotlight from me. But I'm going to go ahead and reiterate some of the points that some of our other speakers have already answered. And so just to make things sink in even better. So first up, some of the limiting factors to consider when considering classification for your project. Terrain, vegetation, anomaly density, percentage of anomalies that are TOI, project objectives, project team, all these things need to be considered to determine whether classification is going to work at all for your site. So I'm just going to walk through each of these and try to give some examples of where maybe they haven't worked or maybe they have limited the use of classification on some sites. Herb already touched on this. We have several tools available to use for classification right now. And terrain and vegetation at this point are not really limiting factors. They are more points that need to be considered when selecting the right tool for the job. Between the Metal Mapper, the TimTads, and the MPV, we can cover a wide variety of terrains and vegetation. Like Herb mentioned as well, you know, we might not be able to go into the densest jungles of Puerto Rico, but we can almost get there. You can see that picture from New Boston. He's getting into a pretty tight spot there. And so we've got a lot of tools at our disposal, and we just need to make sure that we're using the right one for the right problem. Next up, anomaly density. And I think this was touched on earlier. I know Lynn will also be showing you guys some cool data examples after my presentation. But basically what it comes down to is that the data we're collecting doesn't have unlimited information. Right now, we are limited to classifying 1 to 5 items underneath the coil's footprint. The image to the left there is a data plot that a geophysicist would see when processing the data, and each of those colored blobs represents individual items that were under this is a Metal Mapper data set here, but under the Metal Mapper when the queued data was collected. And this is pretty much the maximum number of items that we can really resolve at this point in time. Now, everyone always wants to relate that to anomalies per acre. How many anomalies per acre can I have on my site in order to make classification work? And that's a tough question to answer. If each piece of metal were represented by a single anomaly, and you did that math for a 1 square meter having 5 anomalies, you could do 20,000 anomalies per acre. But I think we all know that that's a little ridiculous, and that's not really the case, because what it comes down to is each anomaly isn't just representative of a single piece of metal. The real question is how much clutter is out there. And this, you get this answer from having a good characterization. And that's a point I really would like to emphasize, is that in order to make classification successful or ensure that you have the right type of site to use classification on, you really need to have a good characterization, because that's what's going to tell you if any of these limiting factors are present at your site. Potential problem areas that are fairly obvious would be heavily used impact areas or OBOD grounds. These are the types of sites that have tons of frag mixed in with the TOIs, and those are the types of problems that we're not going to be able to solve with the current technology. And along the same lines, target selection needs to be approached differently for classification sites. We geophysicists are used to having the benefits of a dig crew that's going to go out there and search a 1 meter radius around each target we select. Unfortunately, when we're using the advanced sensors to collect the queued data over the targets, we need to be we need to be within 40 centimeters of the target of interest in order to trust our data. This means that we really need to be more selective about how we choose targets, especially when we're dealing with these higher density sites. The example to the left there, the red crosses are actually seed items, and the black circles represent 40 centimeter radius around the target selection. Now, typically, if we were collecting EM61 data and digging on it, we would have to have our seeds selected within 65 centimeters of a target. And these were selected like that, but because they weren't within that 40 centimeter radius, these actually were missed on the classification data. Data was not recollected over them, and it really came back to it wasn't a failure during the classification data collection, it was a failure during the target selection. And we have talked about this a lot as a potential solution to target selection. We can use this dynamic advanced sensor data to help us delineate these target footprints better. To prevent something like this from happening in the future. And I just wanted to show you what that's all about here. All the data on the left is EM61 data. We've got three targets shown in the center blob here. And those are targets that may be selected if we were planning on going out there and digging those anomalies up. But when we perform our Temptatius dynamicus, and this was originally a picture of Harry Potter, but that was not okay with PAO, so we went with a generic wizard here. Anyway, this is what happens. You can see that the anomalies that we selected are actually not representative at all of what's really there. And by collecting this higher fidelity dynamic data, we're able to really resolve where the individual pieces of metal are. You'll notice that we didn't even select this piece of metal here. So in the classification world, if we went out and sat our metal mapper on this target here, we wouldn't get any information about this guy here. Similarly, down here, we had three pieces of metal. We selected the target right in the middle of the three. So there's no guarantee that we would get any of these pieces of metal, or we would be able to classify them correctly. So this really brings home the point that the advanced sensor data collected dynamically can really be an advantage to a project. One thing I want to say is that it isn't a magic wand, even though that Harry Potter would have been awesome. But where it's going to work best is sites with medium to high density and small to medium sized targets of interest. Where it's not going to work are sites like this. You know, we have this huge anomaly, almost a pit, you could say. It's basically a pile of 155 millimeter projectiles and a ton of frag. It's not going to be worth it to collect advanced sensor dynamic data in a situation like this. It may do a great job of resolving some of these anomalies on the edge, but at this point, when we're dealing with something like this, it's not going to help us there. So we just need to be able to recognize when the best times to use these advanced tools will be. Another thing that I think was touched on earlier, thing to consider would be the percentage of TOI on your site. And as John put it earlier, the ultimate question that we need to ask is, are we going to save money by doing this? That's the whole point of the classification here. Is it worth it? And how many digs do we need to save to make this economical? And really what this comes down to is the specific site. On a standard site, you might be able to reduce the number of digs by 30 to 40% and break even on cost. But if you have a chemical site or a site where you have expensive evacuations, this percentage may be lower. So you could have a pretty difficult site where you're having to dig still a high percentage of the number of anomalies out there, but it could be a real cost saver if you're dealing with difficult conditions like these. This is an example of a site where we ran into this issue. Fort Rucker is a golf course down in South Alabama. We thought it was a perfect site. It's, like I said, a golf course, so definitely easy terrain to deal with. And we really wanted to be able to limit the digging in the greens and tee boxes, and the golf course was really looking forward to that as well. Unfortunately, ESTCP came along and did a demonstration in coordination with the time-critical removal action we were doing down there. And we ran into two issues, two limiting factors that told us that classification wouldn't work here. The first of which you can see in the pie chart up to the left, and you can see that 50% of the items on this site were either TOI or QC seeds. So if we had the perfect classification, we would be digging half the holes on the site, and we're never perfect, so it would definitely be more than that. The second thing you can see on this on the rock curve to the right, and also on the image in the lower left, is there was a ton of rocket scrap out there, and in many cases it was in pits or very densely located, I guess you could say. And so we weren't able to correctly classify a lot of the TOI due to the limiting factor of anomaly density. So you can see the rock curve at the right there. We had several misses. And the last miss wasn't until the very end here. So we would have, in order to get 100%, which was the project objective here because it was a time-critical removal action on a golf course that is used by the public every day, we would have had to dig the majority of the site. So while we hoped and thought that classification may be able to help us at this site, there were just too many limiting factors. So we went back to the traditional removal action here. And I touched on this just now. Project objective is definitely a critical thing to consider when deciding how you're going to use classification on your site. At Rucker, that was a 100% removal action. In that case, a miss is unacceptable. And when that is the case, the site conditions must allow for high-quality data, data collection and analysis. So we need to have zero to few limiting factors on a site like that. If we're doing an RI characterization, we might be able to afford a miss here and there, but we also need to make sure that we have high-quality data because high-quality data equals a high confidence in the classification. The site conditions may not need to be perfect. You might just be out there to collect classification data to feed the FS, and that can be part of your characterization needed for your remedial action. There might be sites with different project objectives. I'm going to show you one here in a second where the project objective was to remove 75 to 95% of the UXO. At a site like this, we expect limiting factors, and we know that classification is going to be difficult. And since we are aware of that fact, we can design the classification process to meet the project objective, which then, again, redefines what a success is on a site like that. And MMR is the site that I was talking about there. At MMR, our goal is to remove 75 to 95% of the UXO. The issue at this site is groundwater contamination. It's closed off to the public. It's on an active installation, and we are just trying to make sure that explosives aren't leaching into the groundwater at a high rate here. So you can see this rock curve looks pretty similar to the one I just showed you for Rucker. The difference is at Rucker it was a failure because a miss was unacceptable there. At MMR, misses are expected and accounted for in the project objective. So this rock curve then is representative of a success at this site. And this is just another slide to show you that several people demonstrated at MMR. And only one person actually got 100% of the items out of the TOI out there, but they had to dig over 50%. And the average analyst would have had to dig over 70% of the targets in order to get 100% of the items out there. So by designing the classification not to get 100%, but to get the project objective of 75 to 95%, we can save a lot of digs and thereby save a lot of money. So it's important to keep the project objectives in mind when you're planning your classification routine. This is another one that was touched on earlier, and I guess this is probably my opinion, and this, I think, is shared by several people here at the Corps, but we're still trying to figure out what makes a project team qualified. And in my experience, production experience is critical. That allows the team to make their mistakes. And if they don't have production experience, you have to be willing to pay for them to make their mistakes on your dollar. And in that case, you also have to have someone qualified to be able to catch their mistakes. Otherwise, the whole process will fail. Things to look for to ensure that they are qualified would be specific personnel. And that's specific personnel in the processing and the field side. Those are two very different tasks, and it's important to have someone who's experienced on both sides of the field there. A detailed plan. This is complicated stuff. As Marty Holmes in OESS up in Baltimore said, to get better data, you have to expect things to be a little more complicated. And when things get a little more complicated, you have to expect more details in the work plan and in the SOPs. To give you an example of no detail, this is from a draft work plan, and you don't need to read it, but it was one paragraph about classification or about the use of an advanced sensor, and that was all they said about it. That's the kind of thing that's a red flag, that they don't have the experience necessary to develop the detail in a work plan that's needed for this work. All right, so now I'm going to kick myself under the bus here, which is always fun. So my experience at a project site, we had trained personnel, but we didn't have any production experience. We'd all been trained on the metal mapper. We'd all been trained how to process data, but had never done it in the real world. We developed a work plan. It was fairly vague, and we developed SOPs that were pretty general. We didn't have a well-defined system in place to manage the data efficiently, but we had a site with 30,000 targets. What we initially got was we only had the capability to collect less than 100 targets a day. We made all sorts of mistakes out in the field. We collected data with the transmitters off on several occasions. We accidentally broke equipment due to lack of experience. We unnecessarily recollected several targets due to poor file management. And, you know, there's probably some other stuff out there, but I think you get the point. So what we did about it, we learned from our mistakes. We implemented a better infield QC process. Herb showed you the infield metal mapper software that we're now utilizing to make sure that we're collecting good data. We developed even more detailed SOPs, and we also have a database system now to manage our data. So what we can do now is we collect over 200 unique targets plus real-time recollects in a day. We can take a 100-by-100 grid with around 500 targets from starting metal mapper data collection to producing a dig list in 1 week. So basically, now we're ready to be hired. The moral of the story is that, you know, there's a large learning curve involved with doing a production classification job, and classroom training really doesn't prepare a company or an individual to perform this work efficiently. And this could result in a waste of money or even in subpar data quality. So you have to be willing to train them in the process if you're not going to hire an experienced, a production experienced team to do this work for you. So to recap some of these limiting factors, questions to ask yourself would be, what classification instrument is appropriate for my terrain and vegetation? What is the nature of the anomaly density at my site? Am I dealing with a lot of clutter, or is each anomaly representative of only one to two pieces of metal? Will I still have to dig the majority of the targets at my site? Do I need to consider collecting dynamically with TimTads and Metal Mapper? Will that help with selecting targets and ensuring that you're getting everything out there? Do I need to remove 100% of the hazard, the majority of the hazard, or just characterize my site? And are the people I hired qualified? Have they done this before? So now I'm going to move on to some lessons learned here. And what I tried to do here was to talk to people who had been doing the work at different sites around the Corps. I talked to Corps personnel, I talked to contractors, and just tried to get some general lessons learned from them and their recent experiences with classification. I kind of tried to break these out by area of interest, I guess you could say. So these lessons learned kind of deal with the field work. And these are things to consider to ensure that your data can be collected efficiently and that it'll be high quality. So the first thing, the first bullet there, I think, has cropped up more often than not. And it's really important to test your equipment before bringing it to the field. I think we all know that, but especially with these advanced sensors that are still kind of, we're still working the bugs out of them. There's been several instances where we get out to the field, we're ready to start collecting data, and the TIMTADS won't work, or the MPV won't work, or the metal mapper won't work, and that puts the project on hold and can waste a lot of money. In general, field practices, it's very important to train the people well up front and make sure that you train enough people to allow for a good rotation of personnel. When you don't have a good rotation of personnel, we found that not only does the production rate suffer, but the data quality can also suffer at all. This is pretty tedious work out there. For those of you who have done it, you can relate. But it's a lot of staring at a screen and waiting and moving a tractor very small increments, or if it's man portable, then moving the TIMTADS not very far between data collection points. And then another obvious one would just be to plan around whether these instruments, I'm going to speak more specifically about the metal mapper because I know that one best, but it can't really handle a lot of adverse weather. Even a small rainstorm can cause problems there, so that's something we need to consider. The next bullet there, seed before the detection survey. In the beginning, we had a few instances where we had already collected EM61 data, and we wanted to collect advanced sensor data out there as well. The advanced sensor data requires a higher rate of seeding to ensure that each day's data is tested. So we decided to seed after the detection survey. Now what that means is that the processor can't look at the EM61 data to make decisions, or else they'll know where the seed items are. Allowing the processor to look at this data can actually be very beneficial in the decision-making process. So one lesson's learned, and I think that we learned this in several locations, but if at all possible, seed before the detection survey to allow your processor to have even more data to make these decisions on. And then tighter line spacing for EM61 data is critical. Or we could use the advanced sensors, but at Beale, we had one survey done at 0.5 meter spacing and the second survey done at 0.75 meter spacing. The second survey actually ended up adding 50% more targets because we had to be more conservative with our dig threshold. So by decreasing the line spacing, we can actually really increase the efficiency and production rate at our site. Communication is definitely vital. This is one thing that I think everyone I talked to brought up. And, you know, it's communication between team members. It's communication with the stakeholders and regulators. And one thing that I think Lynn Passion actually brought this point up was that you really need to be able to explain why you're doing what you're doing. In some degree, some people may still think of this as a black box. So it's important to be able to tell people why you're doing what you're doing. Second bullet, make sure your classification workflow incorporates your dig team schedule. This is something that's kind of a result of the ESTCP demonstrations. During a demonstration, we have all the time in the world and as many iterations as we want to come up with our final dig list. But in the real world, we really need to work with our dig team. This may mean that we need to classify by grid or provide one dig list, not several iterations. There's not really a right answer. It's just a matter of communicating with your project team and finding a solution that works for everyone. And then verification digs. I know this was brought up a couple times earlier. And again, I don't know if there is a right answer right now, but it really comes down to working with your regulators and your project team ahead of time to develop a plan. One idea that I think is awesome is to use common sense. I know we don't do that a lot in this industry, but it can make a lot of sense when you're using it for selecting your verification digs. If you just go out there and want to do some random statistics involving, you know, I want to be 90% confident that 95% of the remaining anomalies are free of TOI, you're going to be digging a lot of digs out there, and it's not really going to tell you anything. But if we think about where we expect failures, if we think about digging just past our thresholds or in areas where maybe the density is a little higher on the site and it may be more likely to have a failure in that area, I think we can make smart choices about where we select our verification digs to ensure that we really are getting everything out there. And then just a few more things. Develop a plan that allows for some flexibility. There's, regardless of how well you have characterized your site, there's always the option for unexpected things to pop up. New targets of interest or unexpected site conditions. So the plan that you and your team put together needs to allow for flexibility to handle these unexpected conditions. Know what you're looking for. And this comes back again to relying on your characterization. I think that's the most important thing, is to have a good characterization and to use it to plan your classification. One thing I think John Jackson pointed out was, you know, we can detect deeper than we can classify, and that's something that would need to be considered when you're developing your plan and working with your regulators and your project team to really identify your data quality objectives for your classification project. Magnetic geology, I think Lynn is really going to hit on this in his next presentation, but lessons learned from people out there were to take more backgrounds and select those backgrounds from the detection survey. So those are just kind of general solutions there. And ultimately, we just need to prepare for Murphy's Law. Things will go wrong, stuff will break, it's going to happen, but we just need to be prepared to handle it. And we can do that through proper planning, having smart people on board, having a good QC, QA process, and knowing the important failure points that I tried to address some of those in this presentation. So we need to keep those in mind and make sure that we're making our classification decisions as intelligently as we can. So I think together we can stop classification abuse. And that's all I have for you. These are some of the people that helped me out with this, but that's all I got.
Very good. Thanks, Elise. Yeah, stop classification abuse. Love it. Good presentation. And we wish you absolutely the best of luck out there on the PCT. Like I said, we'll be rooting for you. Let us know if you need anything, okay, young lady?
All righty. Yeah, if anyone wants to follow me, I can send out a website link to my blog. So just hit me up with an email.
There you go. And we had a couple of questions that did come in, but we're not really going to have time for them. We'll try to address them in the open Q&A session that'll be following this next presentation. So we're going to go ahead and get started with the next one. And the next presentation is brought to us by Dr. Lynn Passion. And Dr. Passion is a geophysicist with Black Tusk Geophysics. He's been focusing a lot on specializing in the UXO detection classification and trying to apply that to real-world scenarios. So Herb earlier, he mentioned Waikolo and the challenges of applying advanced classification techniques in settings like Waikoloa, and that was a little bit of foreshadowing because Lynn's going to cover that in considerably more detail during his presentation. So, Lynn, if you are ready to go, let's take it away. And, Gene, there we go.
Thanks, Dwayne. Okay, so I'd like to talk about lessons learned, difficult cases where classification and advanced analysis works. I'm just waiting for my arrow keys to start engaging. Okay, so the instrument traditionally used for UXO detection has been the Geonyx EM61 metal detector. By having only a single transmitter and either one or two coaxial receivers, we were always limited with the level of interpretation that could be done to the data. In particular, this limited the application of UXO classification to sites with large ordnance and small scrap, or sites with limited amounts of high-density clutter, or sites with low levels of background soil noise. Over the past few years, a new generation of advanced EMI systems have been developed. You've seen many of these today in Herb's talk, and Elise's talk, and John's talk. These instruments are able to acquire higher spatial resolution data, multi-static data, meaning there's multiple receivers, multi-component receivers, and multi-time channel data. With the increased amount of information that the data from these new instruments contain, we're now able to apply advanced processing techniques to increasingly difficult sites. In this presentation, we'll look at a pair of sites that present some different challenges when trying to detect and classify UXO. On the left is a photo from the former Camp Ellis in Illinois. At that site, and we've seen some data from this site already, there are regions of high density of clutter and targets. There's an impact area there, and it was clear from those figures that there's a high density of targets. On the right, there's some photos from the former Waikoloa maneuver area in Hawaii. And the problems there, the biggest problem is really the significant noise from magnetic soil. You can see from this photo there's some red soil there, and that's due to high levels of iron oxides in the soil. An additional problem is terrain and topography, as was brought up earlier by Herb. So the first site we'll look at is the former Camp Ellis in Illinois. Camp Ellis opened in April 1943. It's located about 50 miles southwest of Peoria, Illinois, and covers an area of approximately 17,000 acres. The facility closed in 1945, reopened briefly, and then was closed again in 1950. The land currently is wooded and used for farming, and you can see from the photos here there's a lot of flat land that can make actually geophysics a bit easier to do here. I guess it was last year, ESTCP conducted a live site demonstration on Area A of Camp Ellis. Area A is a former rockets, rifle grenade, and hand grenade range. And approximately, say, 150 by 250 meter region of Area A was mapped by the metal mapper. Plotted on the right is the gridded image of the metal mapper data. At the center of the data map, you can see there's a region that contains a high density of metallic objects. The TEMTATS 2x2 was also brought out to the site, and it was used to map just that high density area in Area A, and that's shown here in the red rectangle. In contrast to the vehicular mounted metal mapper, the TEMTATS is a cart-based instrument, and it was pushed around the site. The images on the right compares the resulting data maps. At this site, the two instruments produce actually a very similar detection map. And it's a little easier to see what this detection map looks like by looking at profile data. The two instruments have slightly different signal-to-noise characteristics and different transmitter sizes, and thus we would expect differences in the relative sensitivity between detecting very near-surface small items and deeper, larger targets. However, if you look at a comparison along profiles, we see that the data responses are very similar with both instruments, and they capture essentially the same features and anomalies in the data for the site. And what's important to note in these images is that these instruments, these new modern instruments, with their small vector receivers, are much higher resolution than the traditional EM61 instruments. As such, they are able to improve detection in cluttered areas. So the MetalMapper data was used to identify anomalies for the site, and that's mainly because the MetalMapper covered the entirety of Area A. The ESTCP program office then split the anomalies into two groups, a MetalMapper group and a TEMTADS group. The MetalMapper group was in the southern part of Area A, and the TEMTADS group was in the northern section of Area A. And there are numerous common targets that are in both the TEMTADS and MetalMapper data sets that are located in that high target density region outlined in red. The data from the queued measurements were distributed by ESTCP for analysis. Classification was performed by one production group and multiple, quote, expert analysis. So analysts. So these expert analysts were people that had lots of experience dealing with classification and advanced sensor data. All the analysts used dipole sources to model the data and then used the properties of the dipole sources to infer properties of the target and then to submit a prioritized dig list. On the image to the right, it's clear that there's a high density of targets present. In less than approximately 3/4 of an acre, there are more than 1,000 anomalies flagged in the MetalMapper data map. Therefore, in order to successfully apply classification at the site, it is critical to be able to resolve multiple sources within view of the instrument. That's a typo in the slide there. It's not really view of a target is critical. It's really how many targets in the view of the instrument is what's critical. The fortunate thing is by using these advanced EMI instruments, they collect a high enough quality of data from which multiple targets can be resolved. So for live site demonstrations, almost all anomalies are excavated. This allows the STCP to assess the classification performance of all the different analysts and all their different approaches. Excavation of the MetalMapper anomalies revealed that there were 63 targets of interest and approximately 940 non-targets of interest. We've seen some of these rock curves before, but just to give you an idea how these things work, the farther to the upper left of the corner that the curve goes, the better the performance. And the location where the curve meets the top of the plot is when 100% of the TOI have been found. For example, if the analyst is able to dig all of the targets of interest, or TOI, before digging any scrap, the curve would go straight up the y-axis. Okay, so the rock curve on the left summarizes the classification performance of an industry analyst. At their stop dig point, indicated here by the blue dot, all 63 TOI were recovered. Oh, sorry, not all 63. At the blue dot, all but one of the 63 TOI were recovered after having to dig approximately 340 to 350 non-TOI, which is about a third of the total number of TOI. This is quite a good result, as it results in saving approximately 600 more excavations. He did miss one, he or she missed one QAC that was actually an ISO. On the right side of the slide are the results from the more experienced analysts. Typically, when expert analysts work with advanced EMI data, the rock curves tend to go more straight up and appears to be more shifted to the left. And this is relative to rock curves from less experienced analysts. The additional experience of the experts allow them to find UX more efficiently by asking for fewer training data or ground truth to help develop their classifier. Two of the expert analysts suggested the stop dig point where only about 150 non-TOI were required to be dug. In both cases, the same single target was missed by those two analysts, which is quite surprising. The missing target was a rifle grenade QAC. It looks here, these plots actually have to be updated because it kind of shows here that an anomaly 10324 was missing, but in fact there's a ground truth area. So ground truth error, so really only one item was missed. A third expert analyst required more digs, but did not miss the QAC. So given these results, I believe that the classification performance with the MetalMapper was very good. Both the industry analysts and expert analysts were able to efficiently identify the TOI on the site. Of course, some retrospective analysis will have to determine why but all but one analyst missed a QA seat. But the results, you know, they're actually quite good. So on this next slide is the results when using the TEMTADS 2x2. The industry analyst has a little more difficulty with this data set, and the raw curve doesn't have, you know, like that straight-up behavior that you'd like to see. And over half the anomalies are asked to be excavated at the stop dig point. This is likely due to the inexperience of the analysts for whom perhaps this Campbell's data set is possibly their first TEMTADS data set that they analyzed. The two more experienced analysts were able to very efficiently identify the TOI. Again, the expert analysts missed the very same rifle grenade. It was called Target 941. That was missed in the metal mapper data. And at the bottom here is a photo of that missed QAC. Again, you know, we'll have some retrospective analysis to see why this particular target was such a problem for both the TEMTADS and metal mapper data sets. But regardless, the analysts were able to efficiently identify the targets of interest, even when there is a significant density of metal objects present. Okay, moving on to the next site. The second site we'll look at is the former Waikoloa Maneuver Area in Hawaii. At the site, there are very large background signals due to magnetic soils. The soils at the site have a rusty red color due to the presence of iron oxides, and these have a very large response in metal detectors. In fact, the Geonix EM61 metal detector is nearly useless at this site due to the magnetic soil. Fortunately, the new generation of metal detectors have multiple receivers that measure multiple components of the secondary field over many time channels. The additional information means that soil compensation algorithms can be used such that detection and classification can be applied at the site. In addition to the problems of magnetic soil, there are parts of the site that a cart-mounted detector would not be able to access due to terrain and topography. For example, on this figure here, there are some sections there that you would not want to walk with a cart-based instrument. So there were two data collection deployments that used advanced EMI equipment. The first was with the metal mapper. Initially, the plan was to use the metal mapper in a dynamic mode to map the entire site. However, using a vehicular-mounted metal mapper for mapping is not really ideal due to terrain and due to the sled on which the metal mapper sits tearing up the ground, which is not what the owner of the site wanted to see. So therefore, we had to use a Geonix the contractor used the Geonix EM61 to use the mapping, and the metal mapper was deployed only in a queued mode. This figure on the right here shows an approximately 90 meter by 65 meter section of the EM61 data. It's clear why it's difficult to work at sites with high levels of magnetic soil noise. In addition to anomalies due to metal targets, there are many anomalies due to the magnetic soil. In addition, there are gaps here, the white areas, due to outcropping rocks, making it impossible for the cart-based EM61 to do a survey. The second data collection deployment used the manned portable vector instrument for both the digital geophysical mapping and queued interrogation. The MPV is shown in this photo here. It's a handheld instrument. This case being handheld by John Jackson, I believe. And by being handheld, it allows for more areas to be mapped. It consists of a circular loop transmitter and five receivers that measure three components of the secondary field. And here on the right is a map of the vertical component of data of the center receiver. This coaxial vertical component geometry is similar to what we're used to with the EM61. And you'll notice there are none of the gaps that were in the 61 data due to the EM61 being a card instrument. So for the MPV and the metal mapper data sets, the main questions are, first, can we use the multi-static, multi-channel nature of the instruments to improve detection over what we previously can achieve with the EM61? And secondly, is it possible to account for the soil response such that when inverting or processing the data, we'll be able to get accurate estimates of the target parameters? So, as I said, the MPV is a multi-static instrument. and it measures the secondary field by multiple receivers at multiple locations. So this allows us to exploit the shape and symmetry of the soil response in order to improve detection. In this example, we look at the section of the data in the northeast corner of this part of the site, and the image in the center shows the raw vertical component data. And we can see it is difficult to identify distinct anomalies in this data. However, if we plot the components of the MPV data that are most insensitive to the soil, or least sensitive to the soil, we see that individual anomalies due to the metal can be more easily identified. And it actually suppresses some of the anomalies that are due to the magnetic soil. Another approach to improving detection at the site is to fit the expected response of soil at each point in the grid where a measurement is taken. The misfit to the soil model will then indicate anomalies that are most likely to be from metal rather than due to soil. On the right is a map that plots the soil model misfit. And again, there are some distinct anomalies that should be further investigated to determine if there is a target of interest present. And we repeat this process on a part of the site that's probably the most noisy from a soil standpoint. And again, you know, we can see some very distinct anomalies present, and we really suppress a lot of the magnetic soil noise that causes problems with detection. So once we have a method for being able to do the detection, we need to have some way to process the queued data. So when acquiring queued data, the standard approach is to collect a background measurement near to the anomaly location. This measured background response can be subtracted from the queued data measurement. This background subtraction step is really important because algorithms that estimate target parameters from data generally assumes that targets are sitting in free space. At sites with lower levels of mag soil, this is actually a pretty good approach. However, at sites like this, with high levels of mag soil, this process is not reliable. And there are a couple reasons why this is the case. First, there's a significant spatial variability of the magnetization, the viscous remnant magnetization. And there's approximately 30 millivolts variability in channel 3 of the data. You can see this in the figure to the right. That's a very large variation in the background soil. A second reason is that there are variations in the sensor and soil geometry as you go along taking data. When the sensor is close to the ground, a few centimeters change in ground clearance can result in tens of percent of the background response. And when you're collecting data, it's impossible to maintain the same ground clearance for all measurements. So although accurate background measurements are not always possible, you still need a way to account for the background response when processing this data. So I present here one possible option, and that's to model the background response. And what we found is that the soil response for the metal mapper is well represented by a deep source, a deep dipole source centered beneath the metal mapper. So therefore, one approach is to simultaneously solve for target parameters and the source and the secondary source that can model the soil response. So just as an example, target 1074 is an anomaly at Waikoloa. When fitting the data with a single dipole source, we obtain a set of target polarizabilities, so in this left slide, left plot here, we obtain some polarizabilities. Then we repeat the process by doing a two-source inversion. And what we see on the right here is that one source is modeling what you'd expect from soil, and the other source is recovering polarizabilities that are similar to a 37-millimeter projectile. So if you look back at that single source inversion, we see that that single source tries to account for both the target and soil response, and therefore we get a poor match to the 37-millimeter polarizabilities. And since it can't match that library polarizability, this would result in a misclassification of the target. There were 459 queued 5-point measurements. So by 5 points, what they did is, you can see in the photo here, they would take that MPV and they put it on 5 locations and take a sounding at each location. and then they would process the data. We would process the data all at once. Styrofoam was used to elevate the sensor 10 centimeters above the ground just to reduce the effect of the soil response. And since the instrument is a handheld instrument, it was easy to take numerous backgrounds quite close to the anomaly. So here is an example of 5.Q data collected in the noisy part of the site. The white dots, here indicate the locations over the target at which the MPV collected data. When fitting the data, we scaled the background measurements and used the inversion result to produce the most UXO-like polarizabilities. The resulting polarizability suggests the UXO-like target similar in size to a 37 millimeter. We also deployed what's known as MPV3D, which is the same instrument, but it's a 3D version, meaning it has three orthogonal transmitter coils to illuminate the target. And it kind of looks like a mini metal mapper. Instead of using five different locations to illuminate the target, only a single location is required for collecting data. Since there's only a single location or measurement location required, the production rate increases to approximately 40 targets per hour being interrogated. And of course, these targets are relatively close to each other, so that explains the relatively high production rate. The instrument, the MPV3D, also has an onboard inversion for data QC, and this image on the left, bottom left here, is from a screen capture of the MPV monitor after inverting the same data that was shown in the previous slide. And again, the recovered polarizabilities here, they appear to be from a 37 millimeter projectile. So in conclusion, you know, having these new advanced EMI sensors allow for the application of advanced analysis and classification at increasingly more difficult sites. Classification was successfully applied to Camp Ellis, which had an impact area and a high density of targets. And we showed also that at a site that has high levels of magnetic soil, that by having multi-static and multi-time channel data, we're able to, for one, reduce the selection of anomalies through the soil, that is, do better detection, and also devise techniques from which we can estimate target parameters from acute data. And I'd like to thank CERTIP and ESCCP, who funded much of this work, and also Greg Vann and John Baptiste, who did some of the work in Hawaii for the metal mapper collection, and Elise and Amy Walker for providing information about Camp Ellis. Thank you.
Wonderful, Lynn. Thank you very much. Good presentation. And we have a couple of minutes. We had a question that came in that I thought you might answer, and then we'll just move directly into our open Q&A session. But the question that came in that was specifically related to your material, Lynn, was would available commercial software be able to model the geology like you described, or is that capability proprietary?
So I guess we're thinking of UX Analyze right now. And UX Analyze does have a way of they do a multi-target inversion or a multi-source inversion. So I think it is possible. I haven't tried it with UX Analyze itself, but it is possible that UX Analyze would put a source deep. I'm not sure if you can restrict the location of that source, but certainly it would try to, the way they do their multi-source solver, it would actually try to put a source to represent what the soil is. So I haven't tried it, but in principle, it might be able to achieve the same result.
Okay. Another question came in regarding Waikoloa, and that was, could a handheld mine lab instrument be used to either initially pinpoint peaks using a mag and flag operation or discern metal from magnetic soil peaks to support the process?
Right. The MineLabs instrument is a very good instrument for magnetic soils. And that's because it uses a patented approach for doing soil compensation, where they use a specialized waveform from which they can tell, does this decay look like more like soil or more like metal? Of course, this can be achieved by any of these advanced sensors. These advanced sensors, like the MPV and Metal Mapper, actually have even more information than the Mine Labs. My one question for the Mine Labs is depth of detection. I wonder, depending on the site, I wonder how effective it would be. So that's one thing I would be concerned about. I know that for near surface metal, the Mine Labs it can actually do in a mag and flag way do the detection. Obviously, you can't do digital geophysics with it, and you don't have a record of where you've been. But sure, yeah, it does have a built-in soil compensation that allows to do for mag and flag.
Okay, very good. I'll tell you what, we're gonna move right into our open Q&A session now, and hopefully all of our speakers are still with us or have been able to join us. And so the first question that I'm gonna throw out there, and this actually came in during Herb's presentation, but I think it spans almost all of our presentation, our speakers today. So especially the last couple of speakers, Elise and Lynn. This kind of goes to some of the things that you all focused on, but I'll throw it out there to all of you to see if you can provide a good answer for this. But really, it's, you know, what are the weaknesses in the classification technologies, you know, based upon what we're seeing in the field, you know, high anomaly density, just like you were talking about, Lynn, regarding the soil, the geology there. The high iron content of the soil. What are some of the weaknesses that the classification technologies that we're seeing? Y'all can just summarize that real quick.
This is Elise. I think my presentation, that's exactly what my presentation addressed. So I don't know if I need to go into specifics, but I listed a lot of the limiting factors there, and I think there's certainly other things to consider. I think that question might have been addressed during mine. If anyone else has anything to add, feel free.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, I knew that it really did go to to yours and Lynn's presentations. It came in a little bit earlier, so yeah, I thought I would throw it out there if y'all wanted to elaborate or add anything to that. Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you. We also had quite a few questions that came in relative to your presentation, John, and there are several here, and I'll probably kind of lump some of these together and everything, what education and training and experience is needed to be a qualified geophysical analyst? You know, what is it that you're considering? And again, these are some things that I know Elise touched on, that have been touched on. It's kind of part of the central theme, but you know, thought I'd throw it out there and let y'all emphasize those points.
Again, I think we're trying to come up with the perfect answer to that question, but in terms of qualification, it just comes back to experience with the advanced classification data itself and going through the learning curve and making those errors and learning from those errors as you go through the process. And currently, the only way to do that is to have worked on a demonstration project.
Okay. Well, kind of segueing into that then, is there an estimate of how many people would currently qualify as like a lead geophysicist or a field geophysicist for a classification project?
I would say Herb probably has a better answer than I do, but we're getting more and more every day. I think if you had asked this question 2 years ago, I would have said under 10, and now I would say we're definitely in the over 25 to 30 range.
Okay.
Yeah, well, this is Herb. John, that means the sum of project geophysicist and field geophysicist?
I sort of answered on the project geophysicist behalf alone, not field geophysicist as well.
Oh, okay. I would have said a dozen, so who knows what I know.
I'm a lot more lenient than you.
Okay. Bigger than a bread box, right? Okay. Now, John, you also, you know, several of your slides, you were talking about, you know, the key personnel working on the project, including, you know, project managers. And what were, you know, some of those requirements or some of the qualifications that y'all were looking for to work on classification projects? What, can you kind of go over those again, I guess, highlight some of those facets of the PM requirements or qualifications?
For PM, it was a and/or type requirement where the PM could have, I believe it was 5 years of experience on directly related UXO experience for managing that type of project, or one classification project, and we did limit it to one or more. That was for the PM requirement. The SUCSOS was just the standard TP18 requirements. The project geophysicist was experience with the advanced classification data. And then the field geophysicist was at least one project with the production level effort in the field, implementing the system itself and troubleshooting it.
Okay, got it. And John, this one is again for you, but it's switching gears a little bit here. When you were referencing the 75% correct identification of the non-TOIs, is the expectation that 25% will be dug no matter what, or that some number less than that will be acceptable?
That was the minimum requirement in the PWS, so my expectation is we should be able to blow that number out of the water.
Okay.
And so to answer it a different way is we would not expect to dig the full 25%. I would hope that, especially for a site like Camp Slow, where there's so many munition debris type anomalies scattered around the sporadic mech, that we'd be able to get approximately 90% left in the ground, which would mean only digging upwards of 10%.
Okay, right. So we would, it sounds like, you know, our experience is looking that, you know, we would have high confidence that what we're leaving behind are the things that can be left behind. Okay.
Right.
Does the Corps of Engineers intend to have qualifications for data collection personnel, you know, those individuals using the advanced sensors? Do they have to be degreed geophysicists?
Currently, the requirement I would say no, they don't have to be a degreed geophysicist. I think the experience of having troubleshooted these more complex systems is much more important.
Okay. John, I'm switching gears again on you, and believe me, I'll finish picking on you here in just a second. But this is going back to the Range Support Center, the overview presentation, and specifically about MOTCO. And the question was, you know, if the explosion occurred back in the 40s, did the investigation just begin?
That's a pretty complicated answer. In terms of the CERCLA process, yes, the investigation did just begin its official CERCLA phase. In terms of what's been going on at the installation since 1944, there's been a series of activities out there. There's been construction support related MILCON projects, military construction projects. And so we've been finding munitions-related debris and mech since 1944 throughout that site.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I need to look that site up. It does sound like it has a fascinating history, just just for my own curiosity and edification.
Be aware, you can waste a whole day reading the history of that.
I believe it. It sounds like it is a really, really interesting interesting place there, interesting history behind it. Can you kind of also describe the underwater geophysical equipment used?
It was a small boat from ASI. It was underwater towed magnetometer. There's a lot of debris on the floor of the bay there, so we had to keep it elevated off the surface floor a little bit. The hard part with underwater geophysics is the positioning with GPS, and so fortunately the brilliant geophysicists at ASI and the quality control effort at Parsons were able to get us good positioning on that data.
Okay.
If you're looking for more technical specifics, I encourage you to either email me or ASI or Parsons.
Okay, great, great. We had a couple of questions, of other questions that came in on aspects of the Range Support Center overview. I don't know, James Specht, were you able to rejoin us? Are you still with us?
This is James Specht. I'm here.
Hey, James. This was a question about the Fort Ord, and so it was about the air monitoring during the controlled burns. Can you give us a little more information or details about that? You know, what was being monitored? You know, where y'all were doing the monitoring? How long you had to do that? That sort of thing.
Well, as a program manager, what I can tell you is that the air monitoring is conducted around the locality of the burn. The local air board also does co-monitoring. But with respect to specifics, I would have to take that question and get back to you because there are a myriad of analytes that are monitored for, as well as the process is fairly extensive. Generally speaking, the contract under which we do the burn, we have the folks set up 6 to 7 air monitoring stations in the local vicinity and then monitor for I believe it's some of the particulate matter species, 2.5, that kind of thing. And then we're able to compare that to the local air board monitoring and get some kind of a feel for what the impact would or would not have been. We work very closely with the air board as well as CARB on all aspects of the impacts of the burns on air pollution control. But like I said, specifics I would have to get back.
Okay. And that's fine. And for anybody out there in the audience that does have specific questions on any of these topics for our speakers, the speakers, their contact information is on the clue in the registration page for this particular webinar. So by all means, you can use that if we're not able to adequately answer your question today and within the time that we have here. I had a question that came in about the video, and the question was, whether it would be possible to use that video for some other purposes. This one was for the UXO QAQC board. Who do I need to ask for permission? Well, basically, you have to ask me for permission, and I think that's perfectly fine. Just go to Dwayne's401k.com and place a small contribution, and you can use the video anytime. No, I'm just kidding. That video is out there. It's on YouTube, and we are going to have a link for that on the webinar resources page. So please, you can certainly use that. If you would, be sure to attribute it. And I'm just trying to get my nephew's name out there since he put so much work into it. And let's see, Elise, we had two or three questions that came in about your presentation. Let's see here. Let me find the first one. Okay, how is the detection of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 items under the coil affected by how close the items are to each other? And, how does adjacent clutter affect the clarity of the signal?
I'm going to go ahead and forward that one on to Lynn because he's a lot smarter than I am.
Okay. First of all, I don't know what you're talking about, me being smarter than you. But, you know, we've done tests where you take multiple targets and you increase and you decrease the distance between them. And the question is, can you resolve... It depends, like, do we want to... If we're thinking of terms of in terms of detection, then I guess it doesn't really matter. Once you're close enough together, you're going to get a peak and you'll detect and you'll do analysis. And I guess the more interesting question is, can you actually extract the polarizabilities or whatever you're using to do classification? Can you extract those parameters once those targets are really close together? And the answer is really no. You can't be too close, but it's a complicated question to answer because it depends on the depth, it depends on how different the two targets are, and what their decay rates are, and it depends where they're positioned underneath the sensor. I think the important thing to note is that if there is for the analyst to know that they're having a hard time recovering parameters, right? If they're doing fits and something doesn't look quite right, we're not fitting the data as well as we should, then it's up to the analyst to say, I'm not comfortable with this situation, and say, we're just going to dig this anyways to be safe.
Okay. Good. All right, well, Elise, I'm gonna ask you, I'm going to try again. I'm going to keep working on you, Elise. See if we can pin you down here on some. Is the MPV limited to classifying small objects that fit under the footprint of the sensor?
Well, first of all, thanks, Lynn, for answering that for me. That was a great answer, better than I could have given. But also, I don't have much experience with the MPV myself, but as I understand it, when you're collecting cue data with the MPV, you're actually collecting multiple points in some sort of grid. So you actually cover more area than just the sensor head itself. So we are able to classify larger items, even though the sensor head itself has a smaller area. And if anyone else with more MPV experience would like to chime in there, feel free.
Herb?
I'd agree with you. I agree with what Elise said. Yeah, we typically, when they take it out, they take a number of measurements. And in the instance where maybe they're not centered exactly on the target, they're able to see from the data that, oh, wait, we should maybe move our 5 points more directly over the target. So in the field, the person taking the data can actually adjust where they're putting the instrument to make sure that they are covering the target properly so they can actually do some classification.
Okay. Very good. And Elise, here's another one, but this question is a little bit philosophical, but it touches on, again, everybody's presentations. And in fact, I would say that this question, in a way, goes to the core of what we're trying to do with advanced classification. But the question is, you know, in the past, it seemed that stakeholders and regulators all wanted 100% UXO clearance. Are things different now where 75 to 95% removal is acceptable? Can you elaborate on what factors encourage?
And I touched on this briefly, but the goal of the project up there is to reduce the amount of explosives that could potentially leach into the groundwater. That's on an active installation. There's already institutional controls from preventing people from interacting with the explosive material present on that site. So it's more of an environmental issue there. And that's why the project objectives were different at that site, and also because there's a ton of that impact area was used for well over 60 years. So there's a ton of stuff up there. So we're trying to just do the best we can to get the majority of that stuff out. For other sites, you know, I actually haven't had any other sites where there's a different objective. But I think you probably touched on the fact of trying to convince regulators that we have 100%, and I think everyone's agreed that we can never be 100% sure that we have 100%. But the nice part about having the advanced sensors available to us is that we actually gain a lot more information to make us much more confident that we tried our best to address that problem.
Okay. Yes, and if anybody else wants to elaborate on that, that's fine. But I agree. I would say that you know, in the past, people may have been clamoring for 100% removal, and there may have been instances where people were saying that that was done simply because we, you know, walked over 100% of the property or whatever. But if we were telling us that, you know, we were kidding ourselves that that's 100% removal. So I think now with advanced classification, we are getting to the point where we can quantify what we're getting at and have a much better feel for what we're actually accomplishing and have confidence in what we're doing. So I think the key is getting everybody educated about advanced classification, how to use it, you know, and what its limitations are. Herb, did anybody else want to kind of talk about that?
This is Herb. I think Elise gave a very good answer to that question. I've not met any regulators that are interested in anything other than 100% removal of UXO if this concern is explosive hazard. As Elise just said, that it's a different concern in MMR, so it's a different story.
Right. Okay. There was a question. I think, John, this was during your presentation. I think that's right. But again, this is kind of broad. Is there additional training available for MetalMapper and UX Analyze?
There are several classes every year geared towards the UX Analyze training, and there have been multiple instances of actually getting out in the field and using the metal mapper. I'm not aware of any coming up, but I think Amy or Herb would be a better person to answer on future training efforts.
So Herb will start. As I mentioned in mine, we have a training session scheduled in conjunction with NAOC on UX Analyze coming up sort of late April-ish. During this webinar, Nick Villo from Geosoft has sent around an email proposing some dates, so I think that will be announced quite soon. MetalMapper training is a little harder thing. I know that the core offers some training to the core folks. I don't know if it's to everyone else. Definitely, I think that that's something the manufacturer ought to be doing. So those that are interested in that might want to drop an email to Geometrics and ask about training opportunities.
Okay. Let's see. There was a question about, is Corps of Engineers concerned about the lack of advanced sensor data for completed RIs?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question,
Dwayne? Is Corps of Engineers concerned about the lack of advanced sensor data for completed RIs?
This is John. I would argue that the Corps' bigger concern would be the lack of good quality data during the RI. During the RI phase, we're just trying to characterize the site, and I think with a well-characterized site, you can make advanced classification-type decisions based off of that and understand whether or not if your site is qualified for advanced sensor data or not. If you have the opportunity to collect additional data, either in a pilot study or a treatability study, then I would gather the experts and make that assessment at that point, because it does bring a lot to the project. But I don't think all of the completed RIs, I don't think it's a mute point. I think we can carry on knowing what we do from those RIs and possibly have advanced sensors during the remedial action phase.
Okay. And this goes back to the kind of the training question that we talked about a minute ago. Are there any online seminars for UXO project management for contractors? And, well, I'll leave that. Does anybody know of any? I'm not aware of any online seminars other than kind of the seminars we conduct here under the M2S2 webinars. But there may be other venues.
Dwayne, this is Herb. There's a sort of an out-of-date case study based around the pole mount demonstration of ours on the CertifNEA CCB website under the training opportunities. That certainly would walk someone through how you think about doing one of these projects. We are working right now to get some training in place for the summertime for the munitions response dialogue, and we will certainly put that on the CertifNEA CCB website.
Okay. Very good. A comment, I guess not a question here, but a comment came in about, you know, please clarify that characterization is completely different from remediation. No one should, you know, accept less than 100% removal as the objective for a remediation project. And while it's true, I may have confused people by my statements earlier, and that wasn't my intent. But I think Herb and Elise both identified, you know, that there are distinct goals and project objectives between the characterization and the remediation phase. And so I think the key thing there, again, is to identify what your project goals are and to recognize what the limitations of the systems that we have here. So hopefully I did not mean to confuse anybody about that. Let's see here. I think, Elise, this may have been, well, let's say, I can't tell what specific presentation that this question came in about, but it looks like it does kind of cover several of them. It may have been Lynn's even. What data collection rates were observed with these instruments, the full coverage data collection?
For dynamic? John might have a good idea about that.
I think this is Herb. I think the numbers are it's pretty easy to get an acre a day with the metal mapper. You're struggling to get an acre a day. You have to work a long day to get an acre a day with the TEMTADs. Do you know what, Lynn, do you know what the number was at Waikoloa for MPV?
Unfortunately, not off the top of my head.
We quite easily were able, achieving 3/4 of an acre a day with a steady rotation. So I think that's a pretty standard rate, and on a really good day with better terrain, you actually might be able to achieve an acre.
And so is that a production day, or that's a you're out there for 2 weeks and can sprint day?
I would call that a solid production day. We took a real lunch.
10 hours on the site?
Approximately 8 hours of real field time on a 10-hour day.
Okay, which
with, of course, a lot of other odds and ends on either side of that 10 hours.
I just always want to be careful to not extrapolate, to be careful about extrapolating the numbers we sometimes get in our demonstrations, because they're two-week affairs. People work really long hours, and you can do that for 2 weeks, but you can't do that all summer. So we want to be careful about saying numbers that are not achievable.
Yeah, good point. What was the rate that you mentioned, John? It broke up a little bit, and I missed your answer on that. What were you saying?
When we had other activities going on during the day as well, we were sitting around half an acre a day. When we could get in a full production effort, it was fairly easy to get the 3/4 of an acre a day or equivalent, so 0.75 acres per day.
Okay.
But as Herb said, we could concentrate on our work for 2 weeks and then go back to our cushion office jobs. So it's a different beast.
Right. Every site's different, and, yeah, that might not have been a sustainable rate. Okay? Well, I'll tell you what. I think we're coming up on our closing time, and I think that we've covered the questions that we had for the presentation material that was discussed today. I want to thank everybody out there for joining us. Hopefully these webinars are continuing to be a useful venue for information sharing. That's our goal. Please be sure to fill out the evaluation surveys after the webinar. Tell us what we can do to make them better, to meet the community's needs. And I also want to very much throw out a heartfelt thanks to all of our speakers for the material that they put together. Really good information today, some great presentations, and I know that a lot of work and effort goes into these. And so I can tell all of our speakers, you know, I hear a lot of very positive things from our audience, and I just wanted to let y'all know that your efforts are appreciated. I believe I can speak for the community in saying we're grateful for them. So please, if you haven't registered for our future sessions, please do so. I mentioned earlier, Gene brought that up. Our next one is going to be coming up towards the end of April, on the 24th of April. We'll be talking about munitions constituents, then 24 June, MMRP tools, and then we'll wrap up this year's efforts with a session on explosive safety. So if any of those strike your interest, please be sure to register for them. I'm going to turn it over to Gene to wrap it up for the afternoon and tell us what people participated in the webinar today, Gene.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dwayne. Let me go ahead and go through some of our final closeout reminders. We did have over 280 individuals who were able to join us for today's live broadcast. They joined us from all over the country, and I want to thank all of you who not only took time out of your busy schedules to participate today, but also bared with us during a number of technical issues that we encountered today that ranged from some equipment failure to fire drills to a few other things. So again, thank you all so very much for your patience in working with us as we address those issues. Just a reminder, if for individuals who are looking to get credit for participating in our webinars, we do have a page where you can actually look up your seminar records on the CLUIN website. If you visit the following URL and enter your email address, you can have a list of all of the seminars that you've participated in emailed to you for your own records. If you require further documentation, you can certainly feel free to reach out to me at balance.gene@epa.gov, and I'll be happy to work with you individually to see what we can do to help document your participation in our sessions. For those of you that are interested in downloading copies of the seminar materials, we do have the materials available on what's known as the resources or links page. Those slides will be available from this point forward. There's also a link to the YouTube video version of the video that Dwayne shared earlier on that resource page. So if you're watching the archived version, you can also follow the link to the seminar resources or links page that will be open and active from this point forward. We will ask you to take just a moment to fill out the very short feedback form that we have posted on this slide as well. It's also listed as a related URL, and I've shared that direct link in the Q&A box in the lower right-hand corner. Again, this is your opportunity to let us know if there were audio or connection problems. We do know that there were one or two technology issues, which we have acknowledged, and we've been able to resolve those. Hopefully, the problems we encountered in the first hour of the webinar have been cleared up. And feel free to include any notes or suggestions that you can in your feedback to help us to improve future deliveries. If you fill out the feedback form, there is a box you can check, which will allow you to have an email sent to you confirming your feedback was submitted after the live delivery. So again, for those of you that have very stringent requirements to document online webinars, if you save your registration email, you download copies of the presentation materials, and you fill out feedback and get one of those confirmation emails, that should be more than enough to adequately document your participation today. Looks like I've gone through all of the reminders other than the fact that we did successfully record today's webinar. So even if you had audio problems or things cut down on you, don't worry. The recording was preserved in its completeness, and we will post the recorded version of today's webinar in approximately 2 weeks. Everyone who registered for today's webinar will automatically receive an email as soon as that archive is available for free replay. You'll certainly be welcome to forward that on to others that you think will find it to be useful. looks like that truly is the end of the reminders that I have. Again, I want to thank the over 280 individuals who joined us from around the country today, as well as the numerous speakers who were able to participate both in the office, at home, as well as from park benches during today's live webinar. I hope you guys found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and we'll see you or hear from you on future internet seminars. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.